This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho Moon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia, Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Hard-traveling fanboys, hard-traveling fanboys. Hard traveling fanboys.
Place to Be Nation, welcome once again to another episode of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Actually, this is Hard Travelers for Hire. But you see, we're returning to our mostly monthly trek through the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Movie by movie, we're going through, watching each of these, seeing how they stack up, ranking them, and kind of seeing how the movies either improve or devolve in our estimation over the years. And this episode in particular brings us past Age of Ultron and on to Ant-Man. Now, Nick Duke, who is my co-host, I'm Greg Phillips. We are, of course, in Ho-Ho Loon Plaza, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Nick, how are you doing, and what phase of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is this movie in?
This is technically in Phase 2 for some reason. I guess because of the way the production cycles fell and the fact that, you know, Marvel Studios head honcho Kevin Feige was so dead set on launching Phase 3 with Civil War that they kind of, even though you had just had an Avengers film, like you said, they wound up tacking on Ant-Man to the back end of Phase 2 and are pretty dedicated to that categorization of the film, so much so that when the Phase 2 box set was released, Ant-Man was the last movie in that box set. So, for whatever reason that may be, technically this is the final film in Phase 2, even if it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And to answer your questions in reverse order, I'm doing fairly well.
Fairly well. In some respects, fairly well is all we can ask for these days. But this show is about to be much better than fairly well, or fairly good, or whatever the correct terminology would be, because we are joined right here in the frigid, frozen tundra of the Vancouver, British Columbian studios by one half of Geek and Sassy, one of the superstars of Place to Be Nation, Pop, co-host of Talkin' Pop, the newest podcast here on the feed, occasional guest on the Sellers Points podcast. You've heard her all over the place at this point. She's the audio village bicycle. And her name is Jennifer Smith.
Holy shit! Really?
Only in the form of only. It's a compliment.
And you know, that's a Greg. Now that I think about it, that's especially apropos given the little audio production we have coming up later this month.
Well, thanks for that intro, I guess.
Hey, listen, I've been in. You see, you've been on a lot of podcasts.
Yeah,
you see,
sure
so. When you make your rounds, you make your way through the city.
You're making it worse.
Also, bicycles. There's one bicycle in the village. You see, everyone would in turn
have a ride.
The bicycle.
Yes, that is the. Yeah, that's pretty much what you said the first time. I don't understand how this overly long, complicated, drawn out explanation has improved or added anything of merit to the conversation.
Just call me a podcast slut and get it over with.
Well, I would never use.
She
such
will podcast with anybody at any point. That is her reputation at this point.
Right.
But I can promise you this, Jenny. This podcast is disease free. You don't have to worry about it.
Good. So many aren't.
I would not make that promise, Greg.
Well, we're learning all kinds of things this week on the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Yeah, we need to talk about that off air, by the way. You might want to see a medical professional sometime soon.
Very good. Very good, Mr. Wow.
Hello,
Jenny,
Robin.
Thank you.
Is Batman there?
Hello, real cops. hey, Jenny, how are you doing today in all seriousness? Thank you for joining us for this look at Marvel's Ant-Man.
I'm good, and thank you for having me.
Yes, have some.
Oh, God. Anyway, we're very honored to have a guest on, and a guest that has been on the show many times before at this point, and maybe, along with Russell, probably our most frequent guest, I would say. But we are here gathered to take a look at Ant-Man, and it's a movie that came out in 2015, is that correct, Nick?
Yeah, I believe it was August of 2015, or maybe July of 2015. It was summer of 2015 after Age of Ultron's May release, which, you know, is traditionally the big weekend window for Marvel. So no surprise that they put Age of Ultron there in that May window and then slotted Ant-Man right after it. I believe it's 2015. I'll look up that exact release date because it's something we should know, Greg, if we're going to have an intelligent discussion about the film. And that release date...
We never promised to have intelligent discussions about anything.
That release date was July 17th of 2015.
Very good. So 2015, July 17th. Now, this movie is notable for a couple of reasons. And one of the most notable reasons that it is notably, is that it had a rather troubled production process. And it, amongst the notables about it was the fact that it had a director attached, Edgar Wright, who is known for movies such as Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, whatever that movie was called, The End of the World, I think was the name of it. Anyway, he's known for movies, various movies, comedies and whatnot. So he was attached to write and direct it. At some point, he had a falling out with Marvel Studios, Kevin Feige, at all, and was dropped from the project, or left the project, and they brought in a new director, Peyton Reed, I believe is the name, and he kind of picked up the scraps of what Edgar Wright had written. They had a rewrite process, and kept some elements of that, and changed some other stuff around, and so there was a lot of talk going in about how this might be the first dud for Marvel Studios because of all of the all of the issues in the production of it. There were similar issues that arose that had been arising in Age of Ultron and to a lesser degree in Thor: The Dark World. So people were a little bit concerned about this one. Ant-Man is not a very prominent character in the mainstream. Certainly, hardcore Marvel Comics fans knew Ant-Man to a degree, but I'll use myself as an example. I didn't know the first thing about Ant-Man except that his name was Hank Pym. Well, the main character in this film is not even Hank Pym. It's Scott Lang, who I knew absolutely nothing about. So I guess to get us started, where did you guys come into this movie? How did you guys approach this movie in terms of knowledge of Ant-Man? What was your excitement level for the movie? What were you expecting going in? And I'll start with you, Nick, because I think you've probably read the most modern Marvel of the three of us. So what was your knowledge of Ant-Man, Scott Lang, and your anticipation level for this film?
Well, in terms of Ant-Man knowledge, you kind of have to, like you've already alluded to, delineate it into two different characters. Like, the greatest amount of exposure I've had to the Ant-Man concept came through the Ultimate version of Hank Pym, and arguably his most notable contribution to the Ultimate Universe was spraying his wife with bug spray when she was the size of a wasp in a sign of shocking domestic abuse because Mark Miller has no restraint whatsoever. Other than that, the only other exposure I had to Scott Lang would have been as a supporting character. He actually pops up as a short-lived boyfriend to Jessica Jones in the pages of the first two trades of Alias. He's hanging around there before their romance is kaput. So in terms of him actually being and doing Ant-Man things, I have still to this day no exposure whatsoever. My exposure to Scott Lang Ant-Man comes exclusively through the Marvel Cinematic Universe at this point. But to answer your question about being excited for the film, I was fairly excited for it. You know, it looked like it was going to be something different. The trailers were pretty funny, and anybody who knows me knows that I have a something of a man crush on one Paul Rudd. So when he was cast as Scott Lang, that really kind of washed the bitter taste out of my mouth that I had after the departure of Edgar Wright, because I was one of those people who was very disappointed he wasn't going to do it. I'm a big fan of the stuff of his I've seen, And I thought he was really going to bring something unique and different to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I was kind of bummed out when that wound up not happening. So because of Paul Rudd, my excitement level was back up as the movie approached there in July of 2015.
What about you, Jenny? Any knowledge of Ant-Man going in, and what was your excitement level approaching this movie?
No knowledge of Ant-Man. And I think that everything that Nick said, I will agree with, and that's probably the only things that we're going to agree about about this movie. But yeah, I was a huge fan of Paul Rudd, so that was it just sold it automatically for me. Yeah. I'm like, there's no way I'm not watching this. And I love the thought of him as a superhero. It's so different for him. And as far as Ant-Man, like, I had no clue. I just went in totally fresh and no expectations and just let it happen the way it was going to happen.
Yeah, and I'll piggyback off of all of that because I am also a huge Paul Rudd fan. He's probably one of my favorite comedic actors in Hollywood, especially in the modern era where modern Hollywood comedies haven't really appealed to me that much because I struggle to identify with a lot of the lead characters in modern movies. And, you know, it used to be either it would be a character I could identify with or a character that's so cool I wanted to be like them. But a lot of the modern characters are like characters that I wouldn't want to know even in my real life, nor could I identify with. But with Paul Rudd, he always has that everyman quality about him where like he's this dork and he knows he's a dork and he leans into being a dork. And it's just refreshing. You know, something like I Love You, Man is probably one of my favorite movies, period, of the last 10 years.
I love that movie.
Yeah, it's so good. So I was excited for this due primarily to him. The other aspects leading into this movie for me were I'm actually not a big Edgar Wright fan. I like Shaun of the Dead a lot, but I haven't really been crazy about his other stuff that I've seen. Didn't really like Scott Pilgrim, didn't really like Hot Fuzz that much. End of the World was okay.
Really?
But, yeah, I know. People are shocked when I tell them I don't like the Hot Fuzz because it's, you know, a parody of action movies and all that stuff. But I've watched it twice, I think, and I just something about it just doesn't click with me. Shaun of the Dead was I still love, and at the end of the World I liked more than I thought I would.
Mm-hmm. World's
and
End.
Scott Pilgrim is just sorry at World's End. Sorry, that's right. Mm-hmm. I keep saying the wrong name of the movie, but and then Scott Pilgrim is kind of just not my.
Yeah, I haven't seen Scott Pilgrim, so I can't really comment on that. But you know his spiritual trilogy of you know Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End. I really enjoy all three of those movies, bordering on love. So. You know, I think I'm a much bigger fan of the guy's body of work than you probably are.
Right, and I think for me, I wasn't shedding any tears over him leaving the project, basically, because you know I was like, okay, his style kind of grates on me at times, so okay, let's somebody else come in and do their thing. But Ant-Man, on the other hand, I thought Ant-Man was maybe other than Guardians the biggest risk that Marvel had taken. Mm-hmm. A character that is, I mean, let's face it, it's hard to make Ant-Man sound cool. I mean, you think Aquaman's lame talking to fish. This dude talks to ants. Mm-hmm. And rides ants around and can shrink. You know, not exactly the sexiest powers in the world. But I had faith in Marvel. They hadn't led me astray yet. So I was reasonably interested in this. I wouldn't say I was excited about it at all, but I was going in with low expectations, but I was expecting to at least laugh a little bit because of Paul Rudd. So... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, let's start this thing up.
Yeah, let's fire it up. So what we're going to do is, as we always do, we invite all of you to watch along with us if you have the chance. You don't have to, obviously, but if you would like to, pause the recording now and set up your streaming service, your DVD, your Blu-ray, your VHS, your Betamax, your Laserdisc, your... 3D television, yeah. Mm-hmm. Blu-ray disc.
Hey, you actually have one of those in your possession DVD. Right now, Greg. The 3D.
I know that may have been mentioned to Jenny off air. Yes, this. We may have We may have made fun of you for getting in on the 3D television.
Hey, ma'am, I liked my 3D TV. It was really cool until it got stolen twice. So I gave up on that.
Yeah. But the and then if you really want to, there are actually cave drawings of this movie you can find as well. And anyway, well, we're going to pause and give you a chance to do that. When you come back right now, you can set up your player and hit play in 3, 2, 1, play. I said play, damn it. It's not playing for me as a heads up to everyone at home. And now it's got volume, which is not supposed to happen.
All right, that was fine.
All right, Greg, you're on fire to start this one.
Well, hey, one of us has to shepherd this ship because the other one refuses to ever do it. So I am trying to multitask here.
And apparently you're doing a David Sunday-like job of multitasking.
I'm actually brushing my teeth right now as we speak. I have got they're in the opening room here where we see our lovely Agent Carter, Agent Peggy Carter here alongside Howard Stark, an old Howard Stark that looks absolutely nothing like the actor that plays young Howard Stark.
Yeah, that's because this is the guy who played Howard Stark in the home movies from Iron Man 2.
In Iron Man 2.
John Slattery.
Yep. And then this douchebag here, who's a new character, I believe, that gets introduced.
Do they ever actually say this guy's name? Because I watched this today, and I was like, I still don't understand who this person is.
Yeah, they did. He was the head of defense at S.H.I.E.L.D. or some bullshit.
But, right. Like, his name is, like, completely irrelevant to the entire proceedings.
Hank mentions his name to Scott later on.
Yeah.
He's running down the
right, but it's kind of an aside, and he's kind of just, you know, doesn't really serve as integral a role to the movie as this opening scene would suggest to you, based on him kind of being the one who originates this conflict.
They're wanting to show off their anti-aging technology here for this scene.
Yeah, and this is—I think this is the first time I've ever noticed it on Michael Douglas here, and it's freaking amazing.
It's so awesome.
It's like. Don't get me wrong, and we'll have a good chance to compare when we do this next month with Civil War, but as impressive as the young Robert Downey Jr. thing was, I think this might be more impressive because I have not lived in a world where Michael Douglas didn't look approximately like 58 years old, you know, and to have him be more like 35 here is introducing me to a version of a person that I never knew, you know, it's just, it's incredible.
Yeah, it'd be like seeing like a Richard Gere that looked really young, you know?
Yeah.
But I thought they did an amazing job with the makeup, and I think this scene is just to establish Hank Pym,
right,
that he was around and that he exists, and B, to establish kind of his antagonistic relationship with the decision makers, basically the government and everything, people trying to misuse his formula as far back as 1989. But we got to see Peggy Carter again, which is always great. See her interact with those three there, or those other people there. Now we're in the prison with Hank in a really good scene, or not Hank, with Scott Lang in a really good scene. The introduction of Paul Rudd. I particularly enjoyed this initiation scene, if you will, or goodbye scene from the prison.
Scott gets a really good punch to the face in a movie full of good punches to the face.
Yes, that's what we were just talking about. That this movie is littered with good punches to the face. Particularly, there's one later on in a training montage with Scott and Hope, where Scott finally is able to land a punch on her and punch her right in the gut, and she registers it. And he's kind of mocking her. Oh, I'm sorry. And then she turns around and punches him right back in the face, and it's great. Scott's here established kind of a.
What was the purpose of that turnstile that connected to nothing so people could just walk around it? Like, that was like the version of, like, the APA's wood frame door from backstage. That turnstile served no purpose.
I would argue that most turnstiles don't serve a purpose.
Well, most turnstiles, you have to actually walk through them to get where you want to go. He could have just walked around it if he wanted to. That was weird.
Well, I mean, I don't ever walk through the turnstile. I don't believe in it. It makes me feel uncomfortable. It hits you right in the crotch, you know, sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Not comfortable. So here we meet a character that will be quite divisive on this show.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Pena's character, who is Scott Lang's best friend and former thieving partner, who's trying to draw him back into the life of crime because he's so good at it. But unlike the character description I just named, you would think that this guy would be kind of a grimy, almost, I'm picturing kind of like Jeremy Renner's character in The Town, you know?
Yeah.
But he's nothing like that. He's completely optimistic. He's happy all the time. He's always seeing the bright side of things. And as a result, is my favorite character in the movie, as a, other than Scott.
This is actually a funny
really?
Scene.
Really?
This is a funny scene.
Yep.
Yeah, when the kid tries to order a burger.
This kid has no clue what's going on, yeah.
Hilarious.
This feels like something that would just be in like a Paul Rudd movie, you know, not
yes,
necessarily like Marvel
say,
specific.
This feels like it would be a scene in the 40-year-old version or not knocked up or something, you know.
Or Anchorman.
All the way into this scene where he meets with his boss.
Yeah. This whole Baskin-Robbins bit is great. They should just do a movie about Scott working at Baskin-Robbins. I'd watch that.
Or different different escaped criminals coming to work at the same Baskin-Robbins.
Baskin-Robbins, yeah.
And getting fired repeatedly. So,
and,
and
eventually the Baskin-Robbins is like transported through time and space to the planet of the Grandmaster, and Goldblum becomes the new manager of the Baskin-Robbins. I'm all for this. They should make this.
So yeah, so Paul Rudd instantly kind of inhabits this role and turns him into a Paul Rudd character, which, again, this is a case of the MCU, in my opinion. Now granted, I don't have a lot of exposure to Scott Lang, so I apologize in advance to any fans of comic book Scott Lang. But to me, it feels like a case of improving a comic book character through the actor's natural charisma. Do you guys agree with that, disagree with that?
I mean, it's hard to disagree with it because I don't really have much exposure to him. But I will say that, like, from the little bit I've read of Scott Lang, one of the things that did surprise me was how comedic the character was. And so I feel like this might be an example where, yes, it's an improvement just because of how great Paul Rudd is, but I think this might not be as drastic a departure as, say, Robert Downey Jr.'s version of Tony Stark as it was from the comic version of Tony Stark at that time. This might be a little closer in tone based on my limited exposure.
And I think that they try to, like, with Paul, I think he tries to make it a little more grounded, not be maybe sort of as dumb as some of his other characters are. And I feel like it's a toned-down version of Paul Rudd.
And
so even if they're using his charisma, it's still not at full volume.
And he kind of has to, because I think they reference here in this scene coming up that he's got a master's, or in the scene previously, he's got like a master's in electrical engineering or mechanical engineering or something. So he's a smart dude, so he kind of can't play it, you know, like idiot Brian Fantana or anything. He's kind of got to play it a little bit more straight while still being comedic, which is easy for him because he's charismatic as hell.
Yeah, he's an everyman. Like he's a normal guy. He's a smart guy, but he just, you know, he like a lot of us, he makes bad decisions a lot.
Hey, it's that guy from The Dark Knight.
It is playing a
David Das Malchin,
a vaguely Eastern European individual.
Sweet sideburns, too.
Much like the silhouette in the first installment of Place to Be Nation Pop Comic Book Theater.
Which people will be hearing more about in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
T.I. here, right? Playing. Playing
Luckily, they do not lean too heavily on the comedic talents of T.I.
No, but I think he's good here. I actually enjoy all of these. All
right.
I do. I enjoy all of his friends here. I think they all. It's not like they're not asking him to put on a Brando-like performance. He's basically just playing a guy that has only a few lines in the movie, and he's good at it. You know, at that very limited role they give him. But yeah, I mean, Luis is clearly the main guy here of the friends, but it's establishing him as a guy that's clearly much smarter than the people that he's hanging around. And he just makes bad decisions in life and ends up kind of a loser through circumstance more than through being
How about those super sweet driving gloves on Hank Pym? You don't see those busted out very often.
Right. You know, what is the practical use of driving gloves?
I don't know. To make yourself look badass, maybe? That's it. Certainly pulled it off for old man Hank Pym there.
That's well, true. I think it only works if you have a certain kind of car. Like, you can't.
Yeah, good point. Good point.
Yeah, you're driving around like a.
I should get some driving gloves for the van. You know, that would be awesome.
God, that would make you look so badass pulling up to the kindergarten in a couple
we
years.
We haven't gotten to kindergarten quite yet. Come on, Greg. Don't.
No, I said in a couple
don't
years.
Depress me preemptively.
I said in a couple of years, you pull up there and you're playing Cats in the Cradle. As you're
but only the Guns N' Roses version, of course.
I didn't know there was a Guns N' Roses version of Cats in the Cradle.
Oh, yes.
Nick's favorite, Darren Cross.
Uh-huh.
Darren Cross.
You know,
bastion of charisma.
But here we are again, like, and you guys are going to say Nick's favorite throughout this, and I'm just going to go, I mean...
You were ranting about him in our group chat earlier.
I said one thing. How is that a rant?
That's
and I believe my exact comment was, I already don't care. And that's the only thing. I just don't. He brings nothing here. He is like, he is a just bland. I mean, the MCU up to this point anyway, we've talked about on the show how they've improved on that in recent years. But up to this point, they were notorious for giving you underdeveloped, bland villains. And to me, this is like the textbook example of that. He brings nothing to this role. And as a result, the plot doesn't like... I mean, this movie has undeniable chemistry and charisma from Paul Rudd and Evangeline Lilly and Michael Douglas, and we can differ on other members of the cast, but the problem is, this is the guy who's kind of supposed to make the plot move, and he doesn't. He just stands there. And that is my... I think that's my most fundamental issue with this movie.
Where I disagree with you on that is... I'm not going to defend this actor or the character of Darren Cross. The writing is horrendous for Darren Cross. He's just not – he lacks any depth at all. He's just a generic evil guy. But I don't see how he ceases to make the plot move. I mean, the plot moves. The plot works. The plot makes sense.
The plot makes sense, but I'm saying, like, in terms of emotional engagement with the plot, he does not help the movie in any regard.
In the plot making sense, to me, that already puts it ahead of... But we're getting ahead of ourselves. But there have already been movies in the MCU to this point where the plot hasn't exactly been the strongest point, including Age of Ultron. But we will get to that later on. Darren Cross, this is an introduction of him. And other than the fact that he looks like a penis, he doesn't really have a lot going for him. Jenny, what are your thoughts on Darren Cross?
I don't know. I like that actor, Corey Stoll. I like him. I've seen him in, like, House of Cards and other things. He was better in House of Cards. But I don't know. I kind of see it a little bit differently. When I was watching it today, I was trying to see it from his point of view. And, I mean, you guys are right. It's not the strongest thing. But he tries, and there he had a father figure that disappointed him, just like Hope, and he was trying to relate to her on that level, and he was jealous of the technology that Hank wouldn't share with him. So, I mean, all of his motivations are clear, and I don't know, it's not that bad for me. It's better than I think you guys think it is.
Well, I mean, that's fair. And the thing is, like, I think that there's room for generic, or not generic, but for traditional villains. Like, not everybody has to be a sympathetic or empathetic villain.
True.
You know, it's fun to see people let loose and be kind of that joyfully evil character.
I agree with that, but he's not joyfully evil. Like, he's just blandly evil. Like, if he was going big, you know, in the vein of something like Hugo Weaving as the Red Skull, it would make more sense in the context of this movie, but he doesn't do that. He just kind of lazes his way through scenes, in my opinion.
I think he's giving it an effort here. I think he's doing what he can. I think the character, to me, anyway... it feels underwritten in terms of, Jenny mentioned his motivation. I mean, what is his motivation other than gathering a lot of power and money? I mean, that is a motivation, but.
Well, I think that, like Hope, you know, he had expectations in being Hank's apprentice or his, you know, his, Hank being his mentor, and then he felt left out, much like Hope did after Hank checked out when her mom died. So, you know, I see some sort of parallel there. She obviously does it way better than him, but, you know, I can see it.
Right. I think the difference there is, like, ultimately it still, for him, comes down to he's upset because Hank won't tell him about this particle that could bring him success and fame and fortune, which is fine, but it's the same motivation, is it not, that Obadiah Stane had in Iron Man, where Obadiah Stane is kind of this bitter businessman who, you know, kind of resents Tony Stark even existing, but also, you know, he's after power, he's after control, and that's kind of what motivates Darren Cross. But I'm somewhere in the middle, I guess, and then I think the actor does what he can. I wish that he had a few more humanizing moments, like him killing that, him just flat out murdering that guy that happens to disagree with him at that meeting at the beginning is like super evil, but like it's almost cartoonishly evil. It's almost like, you know, at that point, they should have just made him be like this outlandishly evil.
Right, and that, yeah, if they had gone like super cartoonish with it and, you know, had him just, you know, be a little bit over the top, I think it would have worked better for, you know, this movie essentially is a comedy. That's what it's kind of seeking to be, is an action comedy. And, you know, kind of having him be bland takes away from that a little bit.
Oh, the little girl is so cute.
Oh, the girl is great.
Adorable.
Yeah. All the daughter stuff in this movie is really good.
Yes.
He's so
good
ugly.
Lord.
I love him.
Kids are like that, though, man.
Yeah.
She looks like him, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always think it's cool when kids look like the parents. But
that has to be a hard thing to find in a casting process.
Right.
And this guy, I also like this character, the guy, the stepdad.
And I can't place this actor. I've seen him somewhere before, but I can't remember where. He's got one of those faces, you know, one of those that guy faces. That guy.
Yeah, that guy. Yeah. Well, I think what I like about this guy, even though his character at first you hate him, and still you kind of hate him at the end just because of his role. But I think it's because we're conditioned in movies to hate the stepdad character,
right?
And going all the way back to something like Mrs. Doubtfire,
right?
where Pierce Brosnan really doesn't do anything wrong in that movie, but you still hate him in it. So, and in this case, it's kind of the same thing for me. But what I like about this movie is they don't fall into that trap of making the stepdad be like this evil guy or this, you know, jerk that's mistreating Paul Rudd or Scott Lang's ex. Instead, he actually is a good guy. Like he's a decent person who ends up helping him in the end. And ultimately they avoid the story of Scott trying to win back his ex-wife. So in fact, it's made pretty obvious out front that that's not even in the cards.
Right. In the end, he kind of winds up becoming the Marvel Cinematic Universe version of Judge Reinhold in The Santa Claus, where he comes full circle and helps out our main character in the end.
And I think every movie could be helped if at least one character ends up becoming Judge Reinhold.
Judge Reinhold, exactly. Here's that scene you were talking about.
Yep, he's about to be melted, which is actually pretty nasty. Like, I enjoyed this scene on that level because it's really pretty disgusting if you think about it.
Well, and it is pretty cold. I mean, it's, you know, flushes him down the toilet.
Yeah, and like just like the to use the RoboCop line, the rudimentary paste that he's turned into.
Yeah,
that I'm sure tastes like baby food. look at that! Good Lord,
it looked awesome when he did that.
Yeah,
wipe him up.
Little brain matter there. RoboCop 2 like brain matter. But yeah, so obviously we all three of us kind of diverge on Darren Cross character, but Scott Lang, I think, is a character most of us can agree on.
Oh, I mean, there's no doubt about Scott Lang. I think we're unanimous.
Yeah,
on that.
He is a delight of a character that is breathed life into by Paul Rudd. And we've talked about him a little bit, Jenny, but how does Paul Rudd as Scott Lang rank up with some of the other leading stars of the MCU?
Ooh.
Not necessarily. I say rank. I don't mean you actually literally have to rank him.
Yeah, yeah.
Does he belong in that pantheon, in your opinion?
I'm going to say yeah. I mean, much like, you know, the other characters, when you think of Iron Man, you think of Robert Downey Jr. and, you know, Thor's Chris. And, you know, they're, when I think of Ant-Man, that's who I think of. So, yeah, I mean, why not?
Yeah, I agree. I think his, like, his physical transformation to become, you know, the superhero character was Chris Pratt-like in its impressiveness. And then also just his ability to take this character and make him different. Because, obviously, Ant-Man, I'm never going to buy Ant-Man as being on the level physically or just from a perception standpoint as Thor, Captain America, Iron Man, the Hulk, etc. I'm never going to buy that. So instead of trying to make him this cool, you know, superhero guy that beats people up, they just lean into the fact that he's kind of a dork. He's kind of a loser, and he knows that, and he has a weird, lame superpower that he exploits. So I really love what they've done with his character to make him feel like he belongs and to make him feel like he is an important part of the MCU and can fit alongside these gods and these mad scientists and these super soldiers that we've seen on the screen. Big fan. So this is, I know this is another divisive scene amongst us. One of my favorite bits in the movie. I love this. I love every time in this movie they go back to this.
Hey, the first time is funny.
Yeah, so this is based, for those that aren't following the movie, this is the first of a few scenes where, his name is Luis, right?
Yes.
He tells a story to Paul, or to a character in the movie, and it kind of shows you these characters in flashback, all of them with the voice of Luis. So you'll see a woman there that was the cleaner, and then she tells her boyfriend, and he tells his teammate at the local baseball team, and then he tells a former classmate of his or whatever, and it all gets back around to Luis, how he finds out about this job. And it's just a really clever stylistic thing, I think, that actually probably is the most Edgar Wright thing that's in this movie, I think.
That's what I was just going to say. That's definitely when you feel him the most in that movie, is those little cut scenes, cutaways, quick scenes.
That's kind of his go-to, is these cutaways, quick scenes, as you said, they kind of are interspersed throughout his movies. And this very much feels like something that was probably left over from the Edgar Wright version of this movie.
One of the things I like about his stories are the activities that he's doing when he hears the stories. Like right then he was at a wine tasting.
Yeah, a wine tasting, yeah.
Later on he's at an art museum. And I don't know, I just think that's a quirky thing about his character that you wouldn't expect.
Right, you see this guy, and he seems to be a career criminal who lives in kind of a crappy apartment, and he's going to all of these things that you would associate with rich people who don't want the Publix built in their neighborhood. it's quite a change. And now this scene, I don't know why I love this shot of the Russian guy climbing up the light pole and taking out the light. I think it's because it reminds me of Wayne's World 2 for some reason. And I'm not sure if anyone remembers the scene I'm referencing, but Wayne's World 2, Wayne and Garth are trying to spy on Wayne's girlfriend, Cassandra. And so they dress up like the village people. I think, I think they actually are intending to dress up as these actual professions. And one of them is like a utility worker, and he's up on a pole spying. But they end up going in and becoming the village people or whatever. And that shot, even in the theater, reminded me of Wayne's World 2. As we
Your
see Scott.
Weird.
Yeah, it is, but you know, that I am what I am. And that's all I can be.
I knew that was coming.
The break in to the Pym mansion? Would you call this a mansion? I don't know.
I'll just say residence. It's a fairly, you know, I mean, it's a nice house, no doubt, but I wouldn't say mansion. Like,
just an upscale house.
Yeah.
An
older upscale house.
I love this scene, too.
Like a Victorian style.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, because everything in here is very, like, retro. Like, the wood paneling, the appliances even. Like, it's clear that despite being a guy who apparently is quite in love with technology, Hank Pym hasn't updated anything in this house in, like, 25 years.
No, he believes that some things are best done the old school way.
Like, I'm pretty sure that's, like, a first-generation dishwasher he just walked by the way.
No, that's actually the same
dishwasher
I have in my apartment.
Are your first generation.
Just banging them against rocks and stones to...
Now, how much do we buy this sequence here where Scott...
I have no idea. I'm glad you brought that up, Jenny, because this may shock both of you to know, I've never actually been a thief.
Yes. I mean, it makes sense in the same way that, like, hacking in movies makes sense. Like, I just kind of look at it and I go, well, I guess that's how it works, and we just move on. Like, I have
hacking
no...
on Arrow, where you can blow up other people's computers by hacking them.
Where Felicity just carries around a tablet, which has, like, no processing power, and she just taps on it, and, like, oh, look, all the streetlights are down. You know, it's just one of those things that you just kind of eventually go, okay, I guess that's how it works.
But I'm glad you brought that up, Jenny, because that same thing, watching this, I was like, that all looks legit, but that could be completely bogus for all I know.
Right.
I've never even interviewed a professional thief.
It's kind of like how in all the Batman comics, you know, every time you see Catwoman draw, like, the perfect circle on the glass and, like, reach through and stuff. And I'm like, does anybody actually do that? I don't know. But I'm assuming that's how they do it, because I've seen it so many times.
I mean, I imagine it would make things easier on the cops, though. They won't have to wonder what happened. You say, oh, there's a circle in the glass. Somebody broke in here last night.
Right.
So this is pretty cool. Again, I don't know if any of this is legit or not, but right. It's damn cool to watch. I love this.
It looks vaguely similar to what Billy Bob Thornton's character did in Bad Santa, the crack safe, so I'm guessing that's how it works.
It's fun to watch, and I'm intrigued to watch how he uses his mind, his brain, to do things. Mm. Nick and I both talked recently about an episode of The Flash where we got to see Barry have to use his brains again and show how good of a scientist he is. So I'm always kind of a fan of seeing characters that have something beyond their powers get to show off those skills now and again.
Sorry,
it loses
I'm
me
just
a
watching
bit
this. I'm trying to figure out what the hell is going on here.
When he hangs up the blanket to catch the screws popping out, I'm like, oh, come on. You're smart, but you're still a dude. Like, dudes wouldn't remember that.
And this, the air mattress. Like, you know, that door is really heavy, and I know I've busted an air mattress or two in my time with just my fat ass, so there's no way that thing is holding up to that big-ass safe door.
No.
Like,
remember
that's what we don't believe.
Yeah.
Remember, we broke an air mattress wrestling on it one time.
Yeah, wrestling, right.
Wrestling. Naked.
Uh-huh. Yes, naked wrestling.
Greased up,
naked wrestling.
Well, he doesn't find anything except for the suit in the vault.
Yes. Now, this is our first, or not our first, we kind of, this is another interesting approach this movie takes. We kind of know what's going on the whole time to a degree. We don't have an indication that Hank is monitoring Scott, except that he tells Hope before this scene that he's been watched eye. He thinks he may have found a guy. So we, as an audience, kind of know what's going on. Scott has no idea. So Scott is walking into a trap, basically, and we just saw the ant monitoring him there. Scott is kind of in that scary position where he has no knowledge, and the audience has knowledge. And that's kind of interesting, because I think they could have set this movie up differently, where we're with Scott, and we don't realize what's going on, and then they introduce Hank Pym and all that stuff. But instead, they started the movie with Hank, so we know who he is. We kind of know what the deal is a little bit. What did you guys think of that approach versus maybe a more traditional approach where we would have been in the same shoes as Scott in terms of getting exposed to all this craziness?
I liked it. I think it works because you definitely want Hank to be able to have his part of the story. You don't want him to just be like the expository guy the whole time, like,
right,
that just explains stuff. So I think if you meet him first, then you get a little bit more insight into what's going on. So it's not all new information, this is what's happening,
right.
Which sometimes can happen in sort of like an origin story like that.
And since mm-hmm. technically this is a legacy movie, you know, where we have a prior Ant-Man handing down the mantle to a new Ant-Man, you kind of need to develop, you know, an independent emotional connection to Hank Pym. And so by introducing him separately from Scott Lang and not just having be like a middle-of-the-movie reveal and just randomly pop up, I think it makes it a little bit more effective in terms of actually caring about that character.
Here's another really good scene where Scott tries on the suit for the first time.
It's all right, I guess.
And it's all right, I guess. Again, one of our main divergences on the movie.
Yeah, but you're acting like divergent. Like I'm not. It's not like I'm hating these things. I'm just not getting so worked up because you.
My God,
because you are
for
seeking.
Who is
you
so
are
obsessed with.
You are seeking
other people.
You, sir, are seeking.
Really worked up.
To paint this discussion as if I'm trashing the movie, and I'm just not.
Can we all agree? That every time he shrinks, it looks awesome. Especially this first time. This whole sequence where everything is big and he's super tiny and he freaks out and falls everywhere. It's so great.
Be careful, though. Every time we say something good about the movie, Nick chimes in with, it's all right. It's okay.
I mean, it's cool, though, right?
It's okay.
I'm trying. Oh.
It's hard to compete with Malekith. Anyway, Nick not as impressed by the scene, but I dug the scene. Your thoughts on this whole sequence, Jenny?
I just think it's, you know, he's obviously freaking out. He has no clue what's happening. I love how when he's in the bottom of the bathtub and Luis turns on the water and it just cascades towards. I just love how everything looks and his reaction to everything. He just pretty much just tries to keep running. Like, he falls down, he gets up and runs.
My favorite bit is Luis starts to take down his pants, presumably to get into the tub, and his reaction of, I don't want to see this. Yeah. So Nick, tell me about, you said that this scene is just okay to you. What are your thoughts on the scene overall?
It's a fairly cool scene. One thing I don't really understand is, like, how does he fall from, like, bathtub to dance club to, like, what exactly is the spatial relationship of all these places he's going? I didn't quite pick up on that.
Presumably, they established when he first got there that there's a dance club in his apartment.
Like, right beneath it?
Yeah, right beneath it, yeah.
Okay.
So I think, presumably, the floor of their bathroom has
holes and cracks, I guess.
Holes and cracks in it.
Okay.
And now he's falling down a
heater vent to some other apartment. Okay.
Up in the vacuum.
Why are there apartments down bottom and on top and the dance club in the middle? That's the why wouldn't the dance club be on the bottom?
Well, I think it curved. Like when he fell through the thing,
okay.
it curved. It went to
this is a visually interesting sequence. I'll give you that.
What city does this take place in? Is this New York?
I think it's San Francisco. Yeah,
San Francisco. I mean, I've never lived in San Francisco, but
somewhere in California, that whole like Silicon Valley area. Garrett Moore's cameo is fantastic. Yeah, great callback.
I would think that it would be very uncomfortable, very frustrating to live in an apartment complex on top of a dance hall.
Right.
I mean, I don't even like being around my neighbors.
Maybe it's kind of like an homage to the Blues Brothers, what with having this really inconveniently placed apartment, you know? In something of a heist action comedy kind of, you know, callback.
And this is pretty good too. I didn't steal anything. I was just returning something that I stole. The perfect Paul Rudd moment.
Mm-hmm.
That just like putting your foot in your mouth and calling somebody Jobin, you know? What does that even mean? I don't know why I said that. Slap at the base. Now, at this point, I'm still thinking the stepdad's going to be a douche, right? And there is one of the players from Remember the Titans.
Yeah, Julius.
Julius, from Remember the Titans, plays a cop at this jail. And for those of you who might remember, Julius was, I believe, left side to Gary Bertier's strong side.
Yes, that is correct.
Did she say strong side?
Strong side.
Strong side.
And, in fact, this actor, whose name I can't remember right now, he actually wrote an autobiography about his experience on the set of Remember the Titans, and it's called Strong Style Story. So, that's... It's pretty good, actually. Yeah, so Gary Bertier, Julius, has no last name. And here we see Scott's first meeting with Hank Pym. Now, what about Michael Douglas as Hank Pym? Let's talk about him for just a minute, other than the fact that he's old and they made him look young at one point. Also, I believe that he had cancer before filming this movie and had recovered from it before.
Let's not get into that.
I mean, is that true? I don't know. I remember certain details of that story. But I don't remember when it happened in relation to the movie.
Just say yes, and we'll move on.
Catherine Zeta-Jones, man.
Hey,
what
man,
you, say?
You know, you gotta have cancer. There are worse ways to get it, I guess.
There are worse ways to get it. Allegedly. So,
and when we say allegedly, Michael we mean Michael Douglas saying that's the reason.
Michael, see what helps the most is the respect. Actually, that helps the second most.
Yeah. what are we talking about?
Anyway, we were talking about
Michael Douglas and his
only
throat cancer.
Only white man ever do this for me was Michael Douglas.
That was Mike Wallace.
No, it actually is Mike Douglas, but it's a different
right.
Mike Douglas
that's
than
right.
Michael Douglas.
Why did I think it was Mike Wallace? Who was Mike Wallace?
Mike Wallace is the old interviewer from 60.
Hey, that would have made sense in that context. Anyway.
So our thoughts on Michael Douglas as Hank Pym.
I think he's great. I think he adds more to the movie. I think, you know, you kind of need him to play a little bit more of a drier, more sarcastic mentor to Scott's youthful silliness at times, and I think it really works. I enjoyed pretty much everything he did in this movie, especially some of the flashback sequences we see of his Ant-Man in action back in like the 60s and stuff.
Yes, with his wife Janet Van Dyne.
Mm-hmm.
I will agree with that, and I think that father-daughter relationships aren't really shown that much on in the MCU, so it's kind of nice to have the him and Hope, and then also Scott and his daughter. You know, kind of that parallel in the movie.
Yep.
That is a great point that I didn't actually think about, because I've always talked about how I'm a sucker in movies for father-son relationship stories in movies, but I didn't really think about the fact that there's, you know, you see a lot of mother-daughter movies, but you really don't see father-daughter movies that much, especially in our genre of superhero film. It's always a guy with daddy issues or a girl with mom issues. We don't really see that crossover very much. So that's a great point that I never considered.
And it adds a lot to her character a lot, which we haven't really talked about her much. But, you know, the way that she plays Hope is just completely wounded and, you know, has no idea why her father shut her out for all those years and doesn't know why he doesn't trust her to do, you know, to wear the suit and to just take care of Cross on her own. And, you know, doesn't understand any of his past, and she knows that it's there, but he's just not letting her in, and it's just, you know, she's just a ball of, like, what the fuck.
And that's kind of the traditional, I think, narrative of the dad-daughter relationship, is that kind of overprotective,
yeah.
You know, almost to a fault, overprotection, and you kind of see that here through his eyes, and you know, we'll get to her in a minute, because she's outstanding in this. This is actually, I think, the first thing I had ever seen Evangeline Lilly in, because I never watched Lost.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But, Michael Douglas had kind of gone cold for a while before this movie. You know, he hadn't really had any prominent film roles in quite some time. So it was nice for me as a kid who grew up watching a lot of Michael Douglas movies to see him kind of get this prominent role in a major movie like Ant-Man, which is part of the MCU, and to see him hold his own with from a comedic standpoint to hold his own, and of course from a dramatic standpoint. He and Scott get the comedy moments, and he and Hope get the great dramatic moments. And there's one scene in particular near the end of the movie between them, the one that Scott interrupts mm-hmm. with that great the great line about, oh, this is a great moment, which is another one of the great Paul Rudd moments. It's such a great scene, though, leading up to that. Really good dramatic tension, great performances from both. So I was happy to see Michael Douglas make a return here, and it gives me hope that I might one day get the sequel to the classic Michael Douglas film, Hard Rain.
I thought you were going to say Romancing the Stone.
No. I can romance a stone on my own.
Didn't they make a sort of?
Did they? I don't know.
I think they did. It was called something different, though. Let's see. Romancing the Stone. Yeah, a 1985 sequel titled The Jewel of the Nile. Yep. Hmm.
And by the way, that movie that I talked about, that I made that joke about, wasn't even called Hard Rain. It was called Black Rain. But it was good.
Know.
It's actually a good movie. It's good if you like generic 80s action crime movies, and I do. So go watch it. It's about rain and all kinds of other stuff, I'm sure. Now is a good time, now that we're in the Pym mansion, or Pym weird old house, to talk about Hope, played by Evangeline Lilly. As I mentioned earlier, I think this is the first thing I'd ever seen her in, because I never watched an episode of Lost, and that seems to be where she had gotten most of her prominence prior to this movie. But she is great as another character that I have no knowledge of, no attachment to, in the form of Hope Van Dyne, right? Is that her name, correct?
Yes,
if I'm wrong,
Nick. That's correct.
Why does she have her mother's last name and not her father's?
Great question.
That neither of us can answer.
Yep.
So
no idea.
Anyway, she is awesome here, and actually was one of the big takeaways from this movie is another fresh new addition into the MCU that instantly I was interested in and invested in and wanted to see more of. You guys talk about your take on Nick. We haven't really gotten your take yet on Hope. Or Evangeline Lilly's performance.
Yeah, she was really good. You know, not quite as comedic in terms of at least her dialogue as Scott or even Hank, you know, albeit Hank's being a little bit more drier and sarcastic, as I said earlier. But you kind of need her there to play, you know, Scott has to have a variety of straight men to play off of at times. And, you know, while she's a straight woman, which makes, you know, I don't even...
You don't know that?
Yeah, the point being, she does a really good job here, and she actually has, even though she doesn't get a chance to show it off a ton, you guys were referencing earlier the punch to the face that she lands. She actually has a physical presence that was a little surprising, given the fact that on Lost, she's kind of portrayed her character with someone who used her small stature to, like, you know, con her way into various situations and stuff. And so it's a little surprising to see her with such a good physical presence in the rare instances where she gets to show it off in this movie.
Well, I watched her on Lost too, and I always thought she was sort of a low key badass,
right? But like a very sneaky one. Like she was clearly always like scheming her way into situations that, you know, were advantageous to her, rather than going the direct conflict route.
That's true. She was one of my favorite characters in Lost,
mine
and
too.
I was super excited that she was going to be in a Marvel film, and you know, I can't wait to see her suited up mm-hmm. in the next movie.
It's going
to
be great.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think her being that sort of serious presence in the movie helps keep it grounded, you mm-hmm. know, and keep mm-hmm. it from becoming a complete comedy. Of course, Darren Cross is kind of doing the same thing on the villain side, but not to the same level on a consistent basis. But you know, she's kind of what keeps it, you know, moving dramatically. And we've got Paul Rudd who's hitting all these great comedic beats. You've got Luis and all of his friends that are kind of comedic characters. And even the little girl is kind of a comedic character to a degree, because she's just so earnest about everything. And as you know, I love Ernest. So, you know, and he's not in the movie, but I feel like his spirit lives on in this movie. He would have been a great Ant-Man. Like, do you guys think that if they made Ant-Man in, like, 1988, that Jim Varney could have played Ant-Man? Just say yes and we'll move along.
Yes.
Yes.
It would have been great.
But you're right. I think that this could have easily been, you know, just like joke, joke, heist, joke, joke, joke. And then she sort of, like you said, grounds it and gives it some weight.
Glad you mentioned the word heist there, because this is a heist movie by and large, right? And it's another example of Marvel trying out some different. Oh, what's that word? Nick, what do you think?
I don't know.
Let's genre. In this case, a heist film. You know, we got a kind of a political thriller with espionage thriller with Captain America: Civil War. We got a science fiction space opera with Guardians of the Galaxy, and now we're getting a heist movie. And heist movies are always fun, and almost to a T they work. Like, I can't think of too many prominent, well-budgeted heist movies that just flat-out sucked. I mean, I'm sure there are some if I really racked my brain, but I mean, think about the Ocean's 11 series, think about the movie Tower Heist. Usually, at the baseline, they're good. You know, they're entertaining. And I think it was wise to go that direction with this movie. You know, it wouldn't have worked if they tried to do a corporate espionage movie with Ant-Man. You know, I don't think that would have worked as well. I don't think it would have worked if they did a political type movie or even if they did just a generic action movie. I don't think it would have worked with Ant-Man. But what does work is going this heist route and focusing on kind of the natural comedy of that and putting you in the situation where you're waiting for what's going to go wrong for him, basically, right? Where he's infiltrating this building. And they have this really elaborate plan for how this whole thing's going to go along. But as we know in any heist movie, the plan never goes exactly how it's supposed to.
Agreed.
Yep.
I think our first move should be to call the Avengers. I mean, when the world right. is in trouble.
Right. Which I love that joke too, because it isn't that kind of the question that every kid or every like newcomer to these movies asks when they come in and they're like, "What?" Or for any movie franchise, like,
right.
Why don't you just call Superman? Why don't you
and
just
I like,
call Thor?
I liked Hank's answer. He's like, "I've been working my whole life to keep this out of Stark's hands, and I'm not going to go to Stark now." It's perfect. Yeah. Explanation.
Exactly. It is a nice explanation.
I love the fact that in the digital age, we're still using scrolls of blueprints for buildings and stuff as opposed to computers. Like, that's my favorite thing. Hey, just we got to roll it out on the table here.
Look at how old his computer panels look.
Yeah, look at the other panels in the room that are clearly like high definition and stuff that we could easily put the blueprints on. But this doesn't look as cool unless we roll them out on the table.
He's old school, man. He keeps his stuff behind a vault that has to be frozen to be broken into.
Has to be frozen and catch the nuts and bolts with a sheeter or whatever that was.
And it gives him a chance to stroke his sweet goatee.
Yeah,
by the way,
sweet.
Michael Douglas with a goatee is a different look.
Yeah,
it works.
It does.
It does work.
I agree.
Tell us more, Jenny, about how it works.
I like it specifically for him because it goes with the longer hair that he has. You know, it's
and it's probably useful in certain cancer-causing activities, but we won't delve too deeply into that.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Allegedly, again, straight from his own mouth, but yes, allegedly.
Well, that's what got him in trouble in the first place. Now,
y'all are ruining this dramatic moment.
I'm sorry. This is
that is what we do best.
The chance to earn that look in your daughter's eyes. Now, he's going to earn a look at some point, Scott is, in not his daughter's eyes, but in Hank's daughter's eyes. as, you know, you saw the eyes she threw his way when he was in that, you know, at the end of that training sequence, and he was shirtless.
Are you saying, Greg, are you saying he's going to earn a look in another's eyes, much like Garth Brooks and Trisha Yearwood?
Are we about to sing a duet together right now?
No, we are not, sir.
Damn it.
I am not a singer, as certain individuals who attended my bachelor party can confirm.
Listen, Jenny and I have made quite the impression with our...
Yes, you and Jenny, absolutely. If you guys want to sing in another's eyes, feel free. I will sit here and quietly observe, and not observe, listen.
Perhaps we'll do that in another time.
Mm. Yes, when I've had way more alcohol than I have tonight.
And when I've had, I don't know, sugar? I don't know, what the hell, but whatever it is that I eat or drink.
Another thing that I like about this movie is the montages. There's several, and they're great.
Yes,
she schools him on how to punch people, and he informed her he's been to prison. He knows how to punch people, and then she punches him in the face.
Although I have to admit, from a technical standpoint, I didn't see a whole hell of a lot of difference in the two punches, but I guess she put a little bit more of her hip into it. But
she punched him in the face as opposed to the hand. So.
Well, sure, yeah. She wasn't aiming for the fist. That's just my... Listen, I don't have any proof, but my read of the scene is that she wasn't actually aiming for his hand. She was trying to punch him in the face.
You know, controversially enough, Greg, I'm going to agree with you.
You know, I don't think that her aim was that off, but, you know, if it was, that's another issue. But, yeah, so her fighting in this whole montage is badass. Like, when she jumps up and does a Frankensteiner and puts him in a triangle choke.
Yeah.
That was good.
What a great old man attire, too, on Hank Pym right here. Isn't this the perfect old man suit? Like, I swear, like, half the professors on our campus dress like this.
I swear David Sunday dresses like this.
With the button kind of, like, halfway down his chest unbuttoned.
Well, not so much that, usually, but only certain professors. Like, I can see, like, an old English lit professor dressing like that, right? Maybe. I don't know.
Like a sociology teacher.
You ever run into the Spanish professor at Troy, Greg?
Hey, we're not using names here.
I didn't use a name. I asked if you ever ran into the Spanish professor.
We only have one Spanish professor at Troy?
When I was at Troy, they only had one Spanish professor, at least in terms of Spanish language.
No, I've never run into...
Well, then never mind. Like, let's just move on.
What did he look like?
Imagine a dude who's, like, 35, but is trying desperately to be 21, and he has, like, the skater, like, the hair down to his bangs and stuff, and the highlights, and wears, like, you know, the frat boy shorts and, you know, sandals and stuff. Yeah. Yeah, it was certainly a unique situation.
Goodness, frat boy shorts.
Wore, like, you know, teal and pink polos and stuff, you know, brightly colored polos and all that kind of garbage.
Garbage.
Yep, I mean, like that.
I did like that.
I don't even know what we're talking about.
I like how they intersperse in the montage between him fighting, learning about ants, and then their plans for how to break into the facility.
Yes, it's so much more interesting than if they had done it linear,
sequentially. Yeah.
Lineally, yeah. What's the name of Anton? Right, is the pet ant?
Anthony,
another great character of sorts in the movie we haven't talked about. I really grew attached to this little bastard. What about you guys?
He's adorable.
Yeah, I guess so.
And I really like how they use the sugar cubes to practice him using his manipulation of the ants. She just punched him in the face again.
Yeah, and there's the Frankensteiner into the triangle. Beautiful.
Woo, and there's his abs. Yeah, girl. Get you a look.
She just gave him a once-over.
She did. And she liked it!
Okay, those things are cool.
The
little disc things, those are awesome.
Yeah, those are awesome. Yeah. I love those.
And there's the fire ants. You know, this is the first time in my life that I've ever not hated ants.
Just think if they had made Roach Man, Greg, would you have even been able to watch the movie?
Oh my god. I'd rather die than go watch a movie about freaking Roach Man. That would be where Marvel would lose my business. I'd give up on this damn movie series. Roach Man.
Oh, that, now we need Roach Man starring Clint Black, and Garner can just lead the picket lines against it.
I don't know what's the best part about that, reminding myself of Garner's intense hatred of Clint Black for some reason, or the idea of Clint Black as an actor.
Yes. Hey, if Dwight Yoakam can do it.
Now least, you're trying to get me to watch it.
At least Clint Black would be more aesthetically pleasing than Dwight Yoakam, even though at one time he was a sex symbol, which I still don't understand.
No. I don't know. Jenny, who would you pick, Dwight Yoakam or Clint Black?
Clint Black all
okay,
day.
Okay, now here's the complicated question. If the choices are Dwight Yoakam, Lyle Lovett, or Dwight Yoakam and Lyle Lovett, which one do you choose and why?
Oh, my God.
Neither is not an option. You have to choose one, the other, or both.
You have
why
to
would
put
I
yourself.
Pick both? Why is
well,
that an option?
If you were Tanya Tucker, you might pick
Tanya
both.
Tanya Tucker did it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know that 90s like country song, I Feel Lucky? You remember that one, Jenny?
Yeah. She goes, Dwight Yoakam's in the corner trying to catch my eye. Lyle Lovett's right beside me with his hand up on my thigh.
Yeah. Well,
come on, Dwight. Come on, Lyle. We don't have to fight. God, dog.
Hot dog. I feel lucky tonight.
The implication there being she's going to bed them both simultaneously. At least in my head.
I love it.
Well, you know, then I choose both. What the fuck?
There you go. You know, maybe they cancel each other out. Maybe
yeah.
two fours make an eight or
equal a positive.
Yeah, something
that,
like
man.
That.
Something like that.
Are we sure Dwight Yoakam isn't British, what with the teeth and whatnot?
I'm pretty sure
he does. He does look a little bit like the English fella Nigel from Family Guy.
Yeah, he does.
but we're a hell of an artist.
We're missing this movie. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a great scene in the car where Scott kind of is bonding with Hope here for the first time, really, kind of understanding where she comes from, and for the first time in her mind, she's allowing herself to humanize Scott, right?
And he's making it clear to her that the reason that Hank's not letting her put on the suit is because she means too much to him. He doesn't want to lose her like he lost her mother, and Scott's an expendable dude, just a guy. It doesn't matter if he dies, really. Trying to
right.
make her see that point.
If he dies, he dies. But yes, it's a chance for her to see Scott, too, as something other than this guy who's taking this position that I want. Mm-hmm. You know, she sees he's got a daughter, he's got a family, he's doing this for the right reasons. He's not just doing it for a payday or, you know, to not go to jail, for lack of a better term.
If I were her, I'd be like, thanks for getting ants in my car, dude. You know, that's going to be tough to get rid of those.
Yeah, they don't go away once they're in there, yeah. The little devils. But they're better than roaches, my God. Roach man.
Roaches.
Roach man.
Anyway.
Perhaps an idea for the comic book draft.
There we go.
They could use them over in the Tick universe. Maybe they already do, I don't know.
Yes, I could draft Scott Lang and turn him into Roach Man.
The comic book version, Greg, of the Crimson Fox always kind of vaguely looked like a roach
yes.
costume to me.
You are so right, and that's why I couldn't stand her when I was a kid. Yeah. That's why I never bought Justice League Europe. One of the reasons is because she was always in the cover, and she looked like a bloody cockroach. Not
did.
A literal bleeding cockroach,
gross.
But just a cockroach.
Yeah.
And she wasn't supposed to. She was supposed to look like a fox.
Yeah, yeah. The thing was, Jenny, they had a massive like brown tail on the back of her that like when you were viewing her from behind, it looked like the shell of a cockroach. And why they thought a fox had that big of a tail, I don't know.
Hey,
but that's what they went
with.
You know
who else's? You know who else's costume kind of looks like a cockroach? Nick and Jenny.
Who's that?
Was Night Owl in Watchmen?
Well, there's a reason that he would have a cockroach costume because he is quite the coxman.
For only a couple
seconds,
sir. It turns out.
We will find out. We will find out, won't we?
So here's that flashback you were talking
about. This is great. This is...
With Hank and Janet back in the olden days.
Like, I like Paul Rudd and everything, and I'm glad we got the I mean, you know, I'm reasonably glad we got the version of the movie that we got, but I kind of wish I had seen, like, this, like, 60s espionage version of Ant-Man as well. Like, a period piece with these two running around doing, like, Cold War missions and stuff. That version of the movie, I think, would be a really, really interesting thing to see. And I'm hopeful that we'll get some more of these flashbacks in Ant-Man and the Wasp, because they were some of my favorite sequences here in the movie, where it was this or like the little black and white grainy footage that Cross was showing earlier in the movie when he was first
this
introduced.
This is pretty heartbreaking scene here, too, just watching her reaction.
Mm-hmm.
This is a powerful scene from her and from him, but especially from her. But yeah, the espionage angle would have been cool. I just feel like they had done that with Winter Soldier, and I think they needed something a little bit different.
Yeah,
but I agree with you, Nick. It would be cool to see.
I guess I'm thinking of it as a different kind of sub. You know, while they were both espionage, undoubtedly, I kind of viewed Winter Soldier as this more like, you know, contemporary political style thriller, and I was thinking of, you know, that alternate version of an Ant-Man movie more in the style of like a Bond movie, like a silly like homage to like Roger Moore Bond movies, I guess was the parallel I had in my head.
And I think they have a chance now, potentially, if they can get the Fantastic Four back under their power to do a period piece. But yeah. Oh, love this. This is awesome. It's awesome, you know?
You guys are breaking down walls. It's important.
Great scene. I love it because it subverts your expectations, because this is the point in a Marvel movie where they have their heart to heart, and you know the lead character has his okay, this is what my dad wanted me to do moment. And in this case, it's interrupted by Paul Rudd, one of his ill-timed patented Paul Ruddisms, you know. So just tremendous. There's just no, I don't see how anyone could not love this guy in movies.
I like how when he's like, he gets put in this situation, Scott does, and then he gets told what's going on and he doesn't really hesitate that much. He's just like, okay, well, we gotta do, like, what's next?
Yep.
Like, and then he just does it. Like in the montage, you see, like, he's learning how to do it. He's getting the ants together. He's phasing in and out with the suit, and you know, he's good at it. Like, this is what he does, and he's suited to this sort of thing.
Great point. And it, again, what you're getting at is that he is a different kind of hero. You know, he's a hero, though.
Did he just rip away the seal to the interior cabin of an airplane?
I think he. Ooh, I don't know.
I think that's highly dangerous, based on my understanding of how that works. But you know, that's neither here nor there.
Yes, I tend to agree, but the this is a different kind of hero. I think one of the things that the MCU has succeeded at, that I think sometimes people in the online comics community lose sight of, and certainly at Warner Brothers lost sight of in certain movies, is not every hero has to be motivated by the same things and has to behave the same way. You're not a hero because of what your powers are. You're a hero because of how you behave and what you choose to do. And are you going to do the right thing when the opportunity presents itself? So here's a guy who has made bad decisions in life to become a thief, to, you know, alienate his family and all that stuff. But when push comes to shove, to your point, Jenny, he does the right thing. You know, if you tell him what to do, he's going to do it. He's going to go there and he's going to do what it takes to get the job done. And that's heroic, in my opinion.
And now he gets to meet another hero on the roof of the Avengers building.
Another awesome scene.
I love this.
This may have stolen the whole movie in the theater when I watched it. This was tremendous.
Because this is really his first outing. You know, this is the kind of the trial run. He's not really that accomplished yet at what he's doing, and he managed to get one over on Falcon there.
Exactly. And and Falcon has been one of my favorite parts of these movies in general. I think Anthony Mackie is tremendous as Falcon. So every time he appears, I'm going to love it anyway, probably. But their interaction is great. And the humiliation that he feels of falling victim to Ant-Man is great. And it actually gets played off even in Civil War as well when we see them mm-hmm. interact again the next time.
I like how Falcon just unloads two guns at this little dude. Like he's just like, I don't know what's happening, but I'm fixing to shoot this guy.
Yeah, this is really good. A great action scene. Scott showing he learned something from his training. Just imagine, though, for as quickly as he improves here, imagine if he had had the training of John Matrix, who of course trained Bennett and several others.
Well, he would have broken the Falcon's neck just now, so that's probably
absolutely.
For the best.
That would have been it.
Yeah.
Yeah, good point. But this is really fun. This was a good scene in the movie. breaking out there of the...
Yeah. He just starts ripping his wings up from the inside.
And this is almost... I feel like this scene is put in for the same reason that scenes like this are put into every Guy Who Shrinks comic book. So whether it's the Atom or whether it's or even on Legends of Tomorrow, I think they have to put in a scene like this where he kind of kicks the crap out of an established hero to show why he has value in that universe from a, you know, physical perspective. So like you might read a Justice League comic where the Atom beats up, I don't know, the Flash or something, because he shrinks down and gets in his ear or whatever and messes up his equilibrium or just annoys him and trips him up and everything. So they have to kind of put that in there to show you the value of a character who his main power is he shrinks.
Shrinks, right.
And he gets the job done. He brings it back. He impresses them. Now, we've talked a lot about the characters. I think we've hit every character. Unless I'm missing somebody in the movie. So let's talk a little bit about the other aspects of the film. Nick, you mentioned the plot earlier, and it's pretty simplistic. It's a heist movie. They're trying to accomplish something and do that. But from your standpoint, you think the villain is really an impediment to the plot. Is that correct?
Yeah, because I don't care about anything he's doing. And as a result, I don't really care about, you know, the mission they've undertaken. Like, you have three really compelling characters, you know, in Paul Rudd, Michael Douglas, and Evangeline Lilly, and they're giving great performances. And it's really a testament to those, you know, their acting ability and performance they're giving that I care about these characters, even though I don't necessarily care about anything they're doing. Like, I like to see them on screen, I like to see them interacting, but I would be much more interested in, like, a movie of them just talking and hanging out and occasionally doing, like, you know, a cool Ant-Man shrinking bit than I do any of the stuff they actually do in this movie. And I think that's the biggest issue, is I just don't care.
And see, I actually really like the heist aspect here. I like the overall mission. And this scene I thought was pretty well done too, because with him wearing the gloves, I halfway expected him to kill Hank Pym in this scene.
Well, he says later he came there to kill him until he saw Hope there.
Right, right. But I mean, the first time I saw it, I was like, oh gosh, they're going to kill Hank. This is going to be sad. But they don't, thankfully. So this is one of the more effective uses of Darren Cross. Jenny, what are your thoughts on that and this scene and the usage in general, the plot of the heist aspect and what they're there to accomplish, which is to seize technology from Darren Cross and his ability and his desire, of course, to keep it from them?
I'm like you. I like the heist aspect. I always have liked heist movies, but it works. It's not like, I mean, I don't want to say it's a small movie. It has implications that if they don't do this, terrible things might happen in the world, but it's not a like global, like, you know, disaster type thing. It's smaller and quieter. And I think that's why you have some of the performances that you have, because you don't have to blow up things and you don't have to, you know, travel the globe. You know, you've shrunk the focus down to this one aspect. That's what I like about it.
Yeah, I agree. I think they had to go small after Age of Ultron, which had cities falling from the sky, after even the individual movie, you know, Thor, every Thor movie. Until the newest one has felt like you know, it's the end of the world as we know it, or the end mm-hmm. of the universe as we know it. Captain America, same way. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, world-destroying implications. But with this one, and then with Civil War, I liked that they kind of went back down and made it smaller and made it more personal and, in a way that that would kind of predict what would happen later on with something like Spider-Man Homecoming or or Ragnarok, which are very, you know, even Ragnarok is pretty world, now that I'm thinking about it, is pretty world
pretty big
destroying mm-hmm. ramifications. But this one, Civil War and Spider-Man Homecoming stand out as being particularly grounded in the midst of all of these movies that have the entire world will be turned into lifeless husks, you know, implications.
Yeah, and I mean, you kind of have to do that, right? I mean, like, you can't continue to escalate the threat bigger and bigger, or else you fall into, like, Dragon Ball Z syndrome, you know, where everything is somehow bigger and more important than the thing that came before it. So you kind of have to go up and take it down. You have to have a nice balance between the two. And so, yeah, that's what I agree with.
But if you get Dragon Ball Z syndrome, it gives you an ability to cast a short, bald man to stand on the sidelines and masturbate while the two main characters fight.
And hot androids who we totally know they were being created for sex, right? That was the purpose. It was a sex robot.
And in fact, she marries the short bald guy, remember?
I do not remember. I was not nearly as passionate a Dragon Ball Z fan as most.
Krillin ends up marrying android whatever number she was.
While we're on the topic, did anybody else notice? I had the internet had to point this out to me that apparently Killmonger's attire in Black Panther was inspired by Michael B. Jordan's love of Vegeta.
I did not notice that at the time, but I did know that he was a big fan of Dragon Ball. Mm-hmm. Z, that is. Maybe they should have cast him when they tried to do that live-action Dragon Ball movie that didn't work out very well.
I've never seen it still, so.
What about this guy's hair? Okay, tell me, the guy from The Dark Knight, the Russian guy, tell me about his hair. How does he get it to do that? That's incredible. It's like a Roy. It's like a Roy Orbison pompadour. Now, okay, we talked about the plot. We talked about the cast. We talked about this Danny hodgepodge of characters. So let's get to, I guess, the action. We talked about the action pretty much in all these Marvel movies. I gotta say, even on rewatches, I've rewatched this probably 5-6 times by this point. And for me, for a movie that didn't blow me away in terms of action in the theater, I actually am really impressed with how well this stuff holds up. It actually looks better to me on the small screen than it did on the big screen. And I think that's been the opposite case for some of the movies that we've watched. They usually still look good, but I think this one, I think it has some pretty creative action scenes to, again, make a character that I've never found remotely interesting look interesting on screen. But you know, certainly y'all are welcome to disagree. Jenny, let's start with you. Your thoughts on the action in this one.
No, I totally agree. Like, all of the shrinking sequences I love, and my favorite is actually I know you guys, you know, feel how you feel about the villain, but I think he looks badass in the suit, in the yellow jacket suit, and I love the fight scene at the end, especially the part in the little girl's room,
right?
Because mm-hmm. it's different, never seen anything like it before. It's like, it feels like a big fight, and it's super tiny, and it's hilarious, unexpectedly funny, in a, you know, a pretty sweeping fight scene. I mean, they go from the building to the helicopter to the pool and to the daughter's room, so it goes all over, and but it still has those like unexpectedly funny moments.
Oh yes, I mean, I think particularly of the train.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But yeah, I love the action.
Yeah, I mean, I like the action. They act most of it pretty well. I'm not as high on some of the earlier shrinking sequences or the montage as you guys are, but I will agree that the closing action sequence, like the last 20-ish minutes of the movie, that's where the movie kind of hits its peak for me, especially, as Jenny mentioned, once it reaches that final stage of the battle in his daughter's bedroom. That, to me, is like wholly unique and something you wouldn't see in any of the other MCU movies, and to me is unquestionably like the best sequence in the film, that entire train track fight sequence.
Is he the first character in the MCU that we've seen have a child? As far as the main hero, I should say, in the MCU?
Hawkeye count?
Yeah, Hawkeye.
Hawkeye, yeah.
Drax's dead kids, I guess. That would be it. I think those are the only two fathers that I can think of, or mothers for that matter.
Another thing that helps him stand apart. I mean, obviously, yeah, there's Hawkeye. That's a good point. We just watched Age of Ultron a couple months ago.
All right.
But I think the difference here is Hawkeye's kids are kind of just props in that movie.
Right.
They don't really, they're not a part of the movie. They're not
They don't have essential roles in the movie, right? They don't drive the plot at all. They are
there to establish a fact about Hawkeye. Hey, look, right, he's got kids, but they don't really matter. They're just there. With Ant-Man, she is a character, and so she is incredibly important to who he is.
And she is almost his singular motivation for doing everything.
Motivation.
Yeah,
right.
So she kind of has to,
she's the one good thing he has in his life.
Right.
So, other than some, you know, entertaining friends, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So he does get to go to work every day and look at the Black Widow. So, I mean, like, there are multiple good things in his life, Greg.
They are implementing their plan to... it's a highly complicated plan, honestly, which I guess it has to be because of all the security measures of the building.
The plan is simple, but actually quite complex.
Exactly. But I like... what I like about this is how Scott just moves from one thing to the next. Like, he's like, okay, we got to get in here, then we got to do this, then we got to do this, and then he just does it. Like, he doesn't...
Well, they had sketched it all out on the blueprint, so they had it pretty well in mind.
But, like, other things are not going the way that they're supposed to go, you know, mm-hmm, around him, but he's sticking to the plan, and he's, you know, just trying to get it done. I appreciate that about his character.
If only everyone on The Walking Dead would just stick to Rick's plan.
If everyone would have... Well, I'm kind of glad people didn't stick to Rick's plan, to be honest, because it led to one of the greatest events in television history that we'll talk about in just a little bit.
I want to stay on the line and listen to that.
You're welcome.
You're welcome to stay on the line and listen to it. Oh, it was awesome. It was so good. It was so good.
Now Luis gets a little bit of action here.
Yeah, he does.
With a chance to deliver a knockout blow. I love movie knockouts. They're so clean and efficient.
Yes.
Can I ask you guys something that I may have just missed? Like, maybe it was super obvious and they explained it and I just missed it. But why couldn't Scott just, like, ride in one of their pockets to get in the building? Like,
that's because the chamber that is actually holding the little yellow jacket suit is, like, it's like sealed except for that one access point that's, like, 5 millimeters wide. And so he has to get, like, somewhere through something. I don't know. They had a reasoning for it that
you're
I can't
right.
remember.
Yeah, he had to get through a certain...
like a different area of the building or something
right.
like that.
Right, he would have had to hop from like pocket to pocket to really make that work and not
well,
really...
well, they go directly into the chamber. You know, they both go directly. Because like, he takes them in there.
But doesn't he come down from like... he has to come from that one access point that isn't necessarily reachable from inside the room. It kind of extends in from, I think, the ceiling or something like that, because they show that little... don't they show that little, like, computer sequence of, like, the red dot falling through the laser grid or something like that?
I guess my thought was, like, they could get them in the room and then just not cross out and then just, like, destroy the suit or whatever they're going to do to it, you know? Like...
you know, that's a great point, but then we wouldn't have this, you know, this action sequence.
I was overthinking it.
No, that's fine. It's certainly a Dr. Evil-like plot.
Yes, And did anyone else notice that the blueprint of that little area kind of looked a little bit like the Death Star in the original Star Wars, where you have to shoot the thing down the very specific, extremely narrow point to get
and,
to.
And this is like the most expensive magnifying glass ever created, essentially, right, that we have here.
And that room looks like the TARDIS. I mean, you guys don't watch Doctor Who, but it looks remarkably like the TARDIS. And it looks sort of like it has like a honeycomb.
That is a solid
type
gold helicopter.
I'm here's this guy. That is this guy is a stand-in for Donald Trump, apparently.
Oof!
My God, a solid gold helicopter.
The best
one of
helicopter.
The great things. All the best helicopters are using it. Yeah, so I'm just getting caught up watching the sequence now.
Me too.
Let's get to our final thoughts on this one. In a final analysis, to use a quote from a book that may be being adapted here further at Place to Be Nation Pop.
Whether you want it, whether you want it to or not.
Oh, you want it. Trust me.
So,
and if you want it, you can get it easily. Apparently, in audio form, at least.
Absolutely, yes. And you, there will be bosoms rubbing together. let's start with. I'm gonna let you go last, Jenny. I'm gonna let you finish.
Oh, okay.
And I'm gonna start
for
us
once.
Off. I'm going to start us off, and I'm going to say my final thoughts on this one. I continue to really like this movie. I think this is one that when I first saw it, it wasn't anything special to me. It was good, but it wasn't anything special. But I rewatched it with my parents months later, and they loved it, and I loved it. And I was like, well, maybe I was just influenced by how much they loved it, and that made me love it more. And then as I watch it more on TV or as I've watched it on my own, I've just come to realize I really, really like this movie. This is one of those MCU movies. Some of them I turn on, and even though I love the movie, it's a big time investment, and it's a big emotional investment to get into it, and can feel like a chore at times because I have to be in a specific mood. But this is a movie I can throw on no matter what mood I'm in, and it's gonna lift my spirits. It's gonna make me feel good. It's simple. It doesn't overthink things. It doesn't try to do too much. It is a straightforward movie. But I think that's okay sometimes. It doesn't have to be reinventing the wheel. It's never going to be something like The Dark Knight. It's never going to be something like Winter Soldier even. But what it is an entertaining movie that in some ways harkens back to the fun action comedies of the 90s for me. So I really dig this one, and I think our standard baseline for this is there hasn't been a bad Marvel movie yet, right. And I agree with that. For me, I think this is one that everyone should try out, and I think for some, it's going to be different for everyone. I know Russell's not a big fan of it either, I think for a lot of people, this is a movie that will strike a chord with you if you're like me and are just looking for a movie to kind of just turn your brain off and just have fun, and that's what I would describe the movie as. Nick?
It's complicated because, like I said earlier, I think it has three really, really strong performances and three characters who are undeniably charismatic, who I am almost instantly attached to in Scott Lang and Hank Pym and Hope Van Dyne. And I definitely am excited about seeing all three of those characters back in the sequel. But like I said earlier, I just kind of don't care very much about anything that's happening in terms of the plot. Like, you can make fun of me for all you want to, Greg, for like Thor: The Dark World, but I have a pre-existing, emotional connection, and it causes me to be invested, so, admittedly, a little bit overly at times in some of the things that are going on there, or getting to see certain like concepts, visually represented. And in all the movies, even Iron Man 3, which you and I vehemently disagree on, there are moments in Iron Man 3 that reach heights to me. And here, this one, other than that train sequence at the end, it's just kind of a baseline that is closer to mediocrity, I think, than any of the other Marvel movies for me. Still has some good moments. It's still an entertaining watch at times. But It is the only Marvel movie, well, not the only one. It is in that group of Marvel movies that I would describe as, you know, it's all right. It's okay. Not a bad movie, but just certainly in the bottom tier for me.
Do you think that your lack of investment in what's going on is because the stakes are so low?
No, I think it is primarily because of, like, it's a combination of the villain and the actual plot of the thing. Like, Guardians of the Galaxy, I think, is the other one we can point to and go, you know, not a very compelling villain. You and I talked about that in the form of Ronan the Accuser. But there you have the ensemble. You have the team coming together. You've got this, like, you know, kind of different feel with the music and stuff that helps me to enjoy that one more than I probably should because of the villain. And here, you know, you just don't have anything other than these three great performances. And it doesn't have the added advantage of something like the Thor movies where I have this pre-existing, like, emotional investment in wanting to see those movies do well. So it's a complicated thing. And again, I like the movie. Every time I watch it, I find things to like. But it's one of those, you mentioned when you walked out of the theater, you were like, yeah, that was all right. And that's kind of where I've stayed on it. You know, a lot of these movies that we've done rewatches of, you know, my perception of them has, like, risen in the case of something like Winter Soldier or in the case of something like Iron Man 2, I think I enjoyed more than I remembered enjoying. Then there are movies like Thor the Dark World or I'm trying to think of another example. Struggling at the moment, but Thor the Dark World, where I enjoyed them a little bit less on rewatch. And this one is kind of one that has, when I first saw it, I thought it was near the bottom, and it's never really, like, for the better or worse, changed from that perception of it.
Fair enough. And Jenny, that leaves you to finish.
I will finish by saying that, like I said before, I think that this movie is different in having the father-daughter relationships, the heist, the shrinking power. I mean, that's different. It's weird and quirky, and I like it. The performances are great. It looks awesome. Even the music's, you know, pretty good, and we wouldn't really talk much about it, but, you know, it works well with the movie. And I don't know, Paul Rudd goes a long way for me on this one, just because I just adore him so much, and I like seeing him as a superhero. I like knowing that she will be another female superhero in the next movie, because kind of lacking a little bit in this world anyway, the females. So, I don't know. It works for me, and I love it.
Awesome. Yes. So, with that being said, we are getting to that portion of the show where we rank them. Here at Hard Travelers for Hire, we are ranking these movies after we watch them, along with our guests, to this point in the MCU. We're not going to go beyond, of course, because we'll get there in the future. So right now, Nick, why don't you set the people up with our cumulative rankings from the critics and let us know what they say.
So once again, as a brief reminder, this is a combination of the Rotten Tomatoes critic score, Rotten Tomatoes fan score, and the Metacritic score. Each of those on a scale of 1 to 100, whatever the fuck that was. And, you know, for a possible total of 100 points. So 12 movies in at this point, and we'll go 12 to 1 as we usually do. Still at the bottom, Thor the Dark World with 197 points. At number 11, The Incredible Hulk with 199 points. At number 10, Iron Man 2 with 202 points. At number 9, Thor with 210 points. At number 8, Iron Man 3 with 220 points. At number 7, Captain America the First Avenger with 220 points. So actually a tie there for 7th between Captain America the First Avenger and Iron Man 3. At number 6, Avengers Age of Ultron with 224 points. At number 5, Ant-Man makes its debut with 232 points. And then moving on to the top 4, at number 4, Captain America the Winter Soldier with 251 points. At number 3, The Avengers with 252 points. At number 2, Guardians of the Galaxy with 259 points. And still number 1, and the reigning champion, Iron Man with 264 points.
Gotcha. So let's flip it from what we did before, and let's let Jenny start us out with her rankings of the MCU movies to this point in the Hard Travelers for Hire series.
All right, 12 to 1?
12 to 1.
All right. 12, The Incredible Hulk. 11, Thor, The Dark World. 10, Captain America, The First Avenger. 9, Thor. 8, Avengers, Age of Ultron. 7, Ant-Man. 6, Iron Man.
I like where this is going. I like where this is going a lot.
Iron Man 2. 5, Iron Man 3. 4, Captain America, The Winter Soldier. 3, Iron Man. 2, Guardians of the Galaxy. And 1, The Avengers.
Nice. Well played.
It's like way different than you guys' list.
No, I really, really like that. I'm just glad that you're giving the Iron Man sequels the love they deserve.
Well, you know.
Let's keep you in the middle here, and let us hear your rankings.
You going 12 to 1?
12 to 1, yep.
Yeah, really the only agonizing decision I had here on this one was whether I was going to have Ant-Man at the bottom or Iron Man 3 at the bottom. And as much as I have my complaints about Iron Man 3, like I said earlier, it does have sequences in there that I think are thrilling to me, and it has more of those than Ant-Man does. So for that reason, I got Ant-Man at 12, Iron Man 3 at 11, The Incredible Hulk at 10, Thor the Dark World at 9, Iron Man 2 at 8, Captain America the First Avenger at 7, Thor at 6, Iron Man at 5, Guardians of the Galaxy at 4, The Avengers at 3, Avengers Age of Ultron at 2, and Captain America the Winter Soldier still at number 1.
Very good. And now, we get to mine. And I am going to go with, let's see, I am going to go with, at 12, The Incredible Hulk. At 11, Thor the Dark World. At number 10, Thor. At number 9, Captain America, The First Avenger. At number 8, Ant-Man. At number 7, Iron Man. At number 6, Iron Man 3. At number 5, Iron Man 2. At number 4, Avengers Age of Ultron. At number 3, Guardians of the Galaxy. At number 2, The Avengers. And at number 1, Captain America, The Winter Soldier.
Nice.
Yep.
And with that, we wrap up this installment of Hard Travelers for Hire. Of course, we will be coming back on the other side of the break with Read and Watch and the Rundown. Hard traveling, fanboys. Thought I would experiment with that noise. So
it's very Hank Hillish.
Anybody? Stop it, Bobby. If anybody would like to give us feedback on this, please, you can tweet us at gphillips8652. At NickDuke87 and at Jenny Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
No numbers, 2814. Right?
2814.
That's right. Tweet us at any of those locations.
Or you can at join JR's BBQ.
Mm-hmm. At JR's BBQ. Let us know. Send us a Q&A to the loneliest website on the internet. JR'sBarBQ.com. Not happy with that nomenclature, but they're working on it. Or you can join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. We're all there. You can, if you really want to reach us in a one-stop shop, that's your best bet. Go to Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook. Join up. We're all there. We will see it if you post it. Let us know your rankings of the MCU to this point, your thoughts on Ant-Man, and your hopes for the sequel, Ant-Man and the Wasp, which will be out soon. Or, of course, you can send us an email, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. We will look into that if you send it. And other than that, Jenny, I know I mentioned your podcast, but tell us what you've got on your podcast and plate and what you might be bringing to listeners' ears here in the near future.
Well, I actually have a bunch of stuff, like you called me out for earlier. There was an episode of Geek and Sassy. We did an award show called The Sassies.
The Sassies.
I did Spoilers Points, where we talked about our top five superhero comic couples.
Nick, wonder wonder who it was that maybe come up with the idea of doing a top five superhero comic book cover.
Oh, I don't know.
I'll have to dig through the archives and pull up that article.
Yeah, well, you'd be the first people to read it, so that would be good. No, that was I've started on that one, and it's very good so far. I'm intrigued to see how the lists end up.
Well, it was fun, and then Tim Capel and I started a new podcast called Talkin' Pop. So that first episode dropped a couple weeks ago, and people seem to like it. So
yes,
check it out.
I actually listened to that day before yesterday, actually, when I was driving back from the Duke compound, compound.
Yes,
and it was tremendous. It was incredibly entertaining. It very much enjoyed it, and
well, thank you.
Yeah, particularly enjoy. Well, I
should no, I go ahead, say it, say it.
I want to save that story for the future, perhaps an appearance on Talkin' Pop. But I will say, okay. I could relate to JT's stories.
You could relate
VHS glory. I will put it that way.
And sometimes when you were alone, you related to yourself.
I can relate. That's awesome. Anything else you got coming away?
There might be a particular comic book theater type thing that I'm involved with, but I'll let you guys handle that.
It won't do anything to fight those vicious rumors that were spread at the beginning of this show about your role on the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. But that's all tremendous information. And, oh, I was going to say, you're on the show, so I'm going to make this public announcement that the Sassies have already been nominated for a Haffy.
Oh, I'm honored, honestly. That's why we do this, you know, just to get a shot at Haffy.
And the best news of all, thus far there's no competition in the category. So the odds are in your favor that you guys will win that Haffy award.
Trimming the Haffies, the Fullies.
Well, that defeats the entire purpose.
Yeah, we've talked about that for years. We've never been willing to quite get there, you know?
We're very comfortable with our Haffies, thank you very much.
Well, that's fine. I'm sure you are.
Yeah, you're...
That's
all about us. It's all about, we do this show to satisfy ourselves.
The audience of two, Jenny. That's the only audience we care about.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Well, with all that being said, with all that talk of Haffies and Fullies and Sassies and all number of manner of things that we've been discussing here, we're gonna go to the break. When we come back, we're gonna have an abbreviated reading and watching and rundown, and we will catch you on the other side.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Pure O'Puri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military-Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You're involved is what you are. Sorry. I'm back, folks. We're back here with a little quote from the movie Hannibal. Nick, your thoughts on Mason Verger potentially moving into the MCU?
Oh, please, yes. I'll be fine with Gary Oldman Mason Verger or Michael Pitt Mason Verger from the Hannibal television show. Any and all Mason Verger, as long as Cordell is in tow, I'm good with it.
Cordell? You're not Cordell. We are back, folks, and we would like to really thank Jennifer Smith for joining us for our review of Ant-Man. She was around but had prior commitments, so we are going to go ahead and get started with the rundown, which is our weekly look at the news and notes in the comic book world.
Welcome to the rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to the rundown, where we talk about movies too.
And Nick, there's a lot going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest news starts in a certain area of the L-shaped recording studio, an area that gets a lot of action because it's an area known as the DCEU corner.
DCEU corner.
And of course, anyone that's followed comic book news this past week probably heard that Joss Whedon's Batgirl movie, something that we were raving about on this show last year at this time, when it was first announced, is now not happening. The announcement came from Joss Whedon himself. He explained that he was very excited about it. Warner's in DC was very collaborative and supportive, and it took him an entire year to realize that he didn't have a story for it. And so he admitted this and says that he failed the project. And as a result, the Batgirl movie is pretty much dead at Warner Brothers. It's not considered a priority. It was completely tied to Joss's involvement. Joss is no longer involved. Hard to read this as anything but a disappointing announcement, if not surprising, but a disappointing announcement from the Warner side.
Yeah, you would think that when you took meetings on a project that you would have something of a story idea before you agreed to do it. And right. Apparently that was not the case here, which is interesting to me. This was kind of the one thing they had in the one bullet they still had in their gun, Greg, that seemed like it was going to be something that was intended to satisfy fans. I mean, Joss Whedon has quite the cachet in the geek community. I think people were excited about what he was going to do with Batgirl. I think it was one of the ones that everybody was kind of united in looking forward to, and now it's not happening at all. And it's especially, you know, it's especially concerning when you think about, I think there have been recent reports in over the last month or so that Wonder Woman 2, Flashpoint, and Batgirl were the three movies that DC was seeking to go into active production on next, and they just lost one of those. And it just further muddies the water in terms of what DC's cinematic future is. Like, nobody really seems to have a clear indication of what their strategy is as a film line or what their strategy is from a creative standpoint. You know, and it's just very concerning all around. And the larger question is, you know, after the tepid response to Justice League and now him leaving Batgirl, I am assuming that this is Joss Whedon's farewell to his short stint, his short life stint in the DC extended universe.
Yeah, that was going to be my next point. I think that's the big question here, because to be completely honest, really transparent, my excitement about this project had very little to do with Batgirl and a whole lot to do with Joss Whedon. So if Joss Whedon didn't want to do a Batgirl movie, I'd be happy if he did a Mira movie or a Booster Gold movie or a freaking, a Larfleeze movie, for God's sake. Whatever he wants to do with the DC Universe, I'm in for. I'm excited for. If he wants to do a Nightwing, whatever he wants to do. But the concern that I have is, I'm like you, I'm reading this as, okay, this was a nice flirtation, but it's not going to happen. It's not going to lead anywhere, and we're not going to get a Joss Whedon DC movie. And that's a bummer to me. The weird thing to me is there's been this complete anti-Joss Whedon movement on the internet recently, particularly on Twitter. I don't know if it's the Zack Snyder fans or what is going on, but people are just, you know, up in arms. But I was very excited about Whedon's involvement, and I still would be if he were to be involved. But I think it's just kind of a bitter pill to swallow that we got this announcement, because it's, gosh, we're grasping at straws for things to be excited about that don't relate to Wonder Woman.
Yep, that is why I have finally come all the way around to being on the side of just blow everything up. That's where I fall at this point.
Even Wonder Woman.
If you absolutely have to, yes. I think it is. I think you are seeking to build on a flawed, shaky foundation for your universe, and you have lost a lot of the buy-in from the audience. And I think the only way to do that is to wipe the slate clean and start fresh. If you can find a way, you know, whatever convoluted the way that is, to keep Gal Gadot and not confuse audiences and not risk them associating, future films with stuff like Justice League or Batman v Superman, then do it. But my problem is, I don't know that you necessarily can. And I still, like, I understand that, yes, you can make compelling solo movies, but there is still, like, a part of me that wants to see that fully realized version of the DC Universe on film, and we haven't gotten it. And that's, I've seen a great Wonder Woman movie. I've seen a great Superman movie. I've seen multiple great Superman movies. You know, I've seen multiple great Batman movies. But I have yet to see even what I can call a good DC Universe movie. And that is frustrating. And that is still in my fanboy heart what I want to see the most, more than anything else.
Yeah, I would agree. For me, it would be a DCU movie generally, and a Green Lantern movie.
Right, you know.
But, you know, we can't wish too hard. But yeah, I agree with that. I just think that replacing Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman would be the stupidest thing that a comic book movie studio has ever done. Because I think that what she's done, what Patty Jenkins has done, cannot be taken away, cannot be blown up, because it is on that Richard Donner, Christopher Reeve iconic level at this point. And that to me, no matter what plan you have for changing things or blowing things up, she has to be a part of it, in my opinion. She just has to. And you have to work around that somehow. But I understand where you're coming from, because it is it's a depressing situation if you're a fan of these characters that we talk about so fondly when we talk about the comics section.
You know, either how about this? You know. Either blow it up or take the self-imposed restraints off of your not just your film studio but your television studio. Like if you're not, you're not going to, you know, make great films or be able to start anew, then let the television universe have whatever they want, and at least they can give us, you know, a fully realized version of the DC universe that your films to this point have either been unwilling to or unable to.
Yep. Which, again, we don't need to go into this. Probably we don't need to go into this side discussion we've had before, but I would argue that those restrictions shouldn't be there, even if they were making great movies.
Right. Oh. Okay. Yep.
So, you know, that's just my thought anyway. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would.
So, all right. So we got that out of the way. Well, there's another bit to this whole deal, which is Time Warner, which is the company that owns Warner Brothers and DC. AT&T is trying to buy Time Warner. However, that could not work due to antitrust violation reasons. And if that acquisition fails to happen, the Wrap is reporting that Time Warner could be broken up into smaller portions. It would be divided into, according to the Wrap, Warner Brothers, HBO, and Turner, among perhaps other divisions that could spin out of it. This is notable because Time Warner controls DC Comics and could affect that division, that brand. Nick, your thoughts on this story?
You know, I think it's very interesting that this acquisition doesn't happen. It's clear that the shareholders of Time Warner, whether the company is split into three parts or not, have an interest in selling. And we have seen kind of this arms race in content acquisition, you know, in recent years. And I think if this AT&T deal falls apart, it becomes very interesting. I know Comcast was rumored to be involved in the or to be in talks with Fox before Disney seemingly closed that deal to acquire Fox's assets. Could we potentially see Comcast being interested in something like HBO or Warner Brothers? Could we see, I mean, as crazy as it is to think, is it that far outside the realm of possibility Disney might be interested in, you know, at least portions of Time Warner?
At this point, I don't think it's I wouldn't be that surprised by that.
You know, it's
then maybe we'd finally get a good DC Universe movie because Marvel would be making.
No, we would get a good Marvel Universe movie that happened to have Batman in it. You know, we would see the Nova Corps putting down a rebellion from some strange looking people wearing green rings and in a throwaway guy or something like that. But
yeah,
you know, it's just very it's very interesting because it feels like the corporate, like, it feels like DC has their stuff together creatively, but it feels like the corporate structure surrounding it doesn't really have a strong direction, and it could be a shaky next few years for DC with all this uncertainty going on at a higher level.
Meanwhile, sticking to the movie world, Fox is really trying to maximize its intellectual properties while it has them. Because as we know, we talked about this on the show as well in recent months, Disney has attempted to buy 20th Century Fox and all of the rights to their intellectual property, which would include the X-Men movie franchise universe and the Fantastic Four movie universe. But that has not come to fruition yet. That's still in discussions the same way as the AT&T Time Warner merger is being discussed. So in the meantime, Fox still has these properties and they're going to do with them what they will. And the latest announcement in that regard is not a Fantastic Four reboot again, but rather that 20th Century Fox is going full bore into a Silver Surfer movie. And the interesting news that came out this week, according to the Hollywood Reporter, is that the writer for this standalone Silver Surfer movie, Brian K. Vaughan. Now, if you're not super familiar with comics, or if you're not a huge fan of things like Saga or Why the Last Man, that name may not mean anything to you. But Brian K. Vaughan is considered by a lot of people to be, if not the best, then one of the three or four best writers of his generation. He came to fame in the the first decade of this century in the 2000s with Why the Last Man, with the ongoing epic saga, also with a variety of runs on superhero titles as well. But he is and of course The Runaways is his brainchild, which has been a turning TV show and has a huge following. So Brian K. Vaughan writing a Silver Surfer standalone movie that isn't tired to the inherent lameness of the Fantastic Four. Sorry, Fantastic Four fans. I am all about this.
Yeah, it's certainly certainly interesting. I'm looking at his Wikipedia right now. Does he have? He has a little bit of television writing experience, but I'm not seeing any film writing experience whatsoever, which makes it very interesting. Which isn't to say that, you know, he's incapable of doing the job. I'm not suggesting that at all.
I mean, he's written treatments for a Why the Last Man adaptation that never took off. He wanted it. The thing is, he wanted it to be like an HBO series.
He also apparently hasn't happened yet. He also apparently had an uncredited recurring role in the first season of Daredevil.
Wow,
that I didn't know. So
me either.
But yeah, you know, he's got a great mind, and the character of the Silver Surfer and the concept seems like something that would naturally lend himself to his abilities. I mean, he's kind of been recognized in recent years for Saga as this great writer of high concept science fiction that, you know, I think Silver Surfer would have to be. So I don't know that this is actually going to happen. I think it's just one of those things that Fox is throwing against the wall right now, you know, to kind of at least have something in development in case the Disney falls apart. But if it does wind up happening, I'll certainly be there to check it out.
Certainly. And switching paths here, staying with movies a little bit, famed director and writer of both movies and comics, Kevin Smith, had kind of a scary week. He tweeted out this week that he was on his way to he was filming a new stand-up special and had a massive heart attack. He had a what's known as the Widowmaker, 100% blockage of one of his arteries. And thankfully survived and looks like he's going to be okay. But kind of a scary moment where we almost lost one of the influential and prominent writers, directors of our time.
That's true. Yeah, I'm certainly glad he's doing better, and I know it was especially traumatic for you, given that one of your two celebrity lookalikes almost bit the big one.
Two? Wait a minute.
Well, yeah,
he was my one.
Don't you remember the other one that we had revealed to us this past weekend?
Not Kane, but
you know, certain individuals who had negative run-ins with Kane during Royal Rumbles in years past.
Oh, God. Drew Carey. I forgot. I do not look like Drew Carey.
I didn't say you did. I'm just saying it's something that has been said about you.
Your wife said it about me.
Well, I'm not my wife, sir. I can't answer for that. But I can laugh at it.
Oh, Drew Carey. Not that there's anything wrong with Drew Carey, mind you. I'm not knocking Drew Carey. That's not what I'm saying, folks. I'm not insulting Drew Carey. Drew Carey's a fine young man. Drew Carey's got a good career going for him. I have for Drew Carey. I'm just saying that I, in my opinion, do not look like Drew Carey. But then again, that's just my opinion. Quite frankly. Now, moving on to the next item on our list here, we have a departure from Marvel Comics of a prompt longtime Marvel exclusive artist, and that is Chris Samnee, known for his iconic turn with Mark Waid on Daredevil, currently working on Captain America with Mark Waid. He's announced that his 10-year tenure at Marvel is coming to an end. He says he's finished his contract with Marvel. Captain America number 700 by him and Waid will be his last issue. He says he's super excited about what's next. Nick, are you reading this like I am, as he's heading over to DC?
You know, I don't know that he's necessarily heading over to DC immediately. I think there's – we have seen the trend in recent years be that whenever these high-profile creators leave, they tend to do a little bit of self-created work, something they can own for a little while and before they re-up with another member of the Big Two. You know, maybe he goes straight to DC. I would imagine he'll probably work on some Image stuff first before eventually going to DC. And just knowing the work he's done in the past, you know, I'm not a hardcore fan of his. You know, I know a little bit of his Daredevil work and some of his recent Captain America work. But if he is going to go over to DC, in my opinion, his style would fit so well with that Justice Society title they've been talking about for years. And I think it would make a lot of sense if he wound up doing that with whoever's going to write it at Marvel. But that's just a bit of fantasy booking in my head. So, you know, very interesting to see one of the higher profile artists now a free agent in the comics world.
Yes, indeed. Very, very interesting. And I'm also curious what's next for Mark Waid, because correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, I didn't see his name attached to any of the big upcoming projects at Marvel.
I'm not aware of any as well.
And so I'm wondering if perhaps he could be making his way back to DC at some point too.
Yeah, that would be interesting. You know, there was obviously a little bit of bad blood between him and DC for whatever reason there. So not outside the realm of possibility, but I think that would be more surprising than some of the other creator moves that have been made in recent years.
And with all that being said, we have one last item to address, and it's also in the world of comics, print comics. And this is an announcement by Diamond Distributors, which is the way that – and I'm having trouble right now. Anyway, the entity that distributes comics, it has a monopoly on distribution. It's the reason if your local comic shop has a comic, it's because Diamond delivered it. And the condition in which it was delivered, well, that's oftentimes not for us to say. But nonetheless, Diamond made an announcement this week that it is going to release a cloud-based software app called Pullbot. It will allow comic shop customers to pre-order their titles and products from their local shop, but basically it puts all the power in the hands of the consumer to order their comics for them. So it kind of cuts out the middleman there. You get to pick your pull list, put it together, it'll get delivered to your local shop. The local shop still gets the business, but saves the time of having to keep up with your pull list and potentially any issues that could arise from there. So on the surface, this sounds like a pretty cool thing from Diamond, Nick.
Yeah, it does. You know, obviously the rub here is whether Diamond can actually deliver on the promises of this press release. And as you know, you probably know, Greg, people who write press releases rarely have any intention of actually delivering on promises therein. So it's one of those things.
I'm not commenting on that. I'm not dignifying that.
It's one of those things where Diamond has something of a bad reputation when it comes to customer service in general, whether that be at the retailer level or the consumer level. So it's a great idea.
I heard a rumor, though, that Diamond don't give a damn about their bad reputation.
That's actually not a rumor. That's been pretty well proven at this point. They don't give a damn about their reputation or their customers because they have a monopoly. But that's neither here nor there. Again, in theory, a fantastic idea. If it even works 80%, you know, of what it should or what they're saying it will, then I think it is potentially a game changer in terms of the way that we as comics fans interact with our comic shops and the way our orders are placed. But you know, the proof is going to have to be in the app / pudding, as it were.
Indeed. And with that, that wraps up the rundown for another week. And hope you enjoyed that one. But we are going to roll right on into a segment that's been here since the beginning of the longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
And that segment is called Reading and Watching. Now, I read the first two pages of that X-Men, what is it called, Nick?
Grand Design, number one.
Grand Design. And it looks swell, but that's all I read of it. We watched a lot of New Japan Pro Wrestling. How many hours of New Japan we watched this
past God, weekend? Greg, I legitimately don't know. I had 58 episodes on my DVR. I have 13 now. Now, granted, we deleted some. So that's 45. I think we deleted about – we probably watched legitimately about 30 hours of New Japan, somewhere in that
– Yes.
Somewhere in that realm.
It was good.
It was.
But it didn't leave a lot of time for reading.
No, it did not. But I did do some reading because of after you left on Sunday and various times in the bathroom. And then today I had a little bit more free time than I typically do during the week. So I actually did quite a bit. I'm not going to run down issue numbers because I don't have my books here in front of you. But I will tell you that I am – caught up to date on several titles, and I'll just kind of go through them, those books one by one. Batman, I read several issues of that. Those issues involved the two-part Wonder Woman crossover that I thought was just outstanding. It's kind of the spiritual companion to the Batman Superman two-parter that we got, and in that both are kind of dealing with what the status quo of Batman's relationship with his two closest allies is going to be now that he's getting married to Catwoman. And Joelle Jones was on the art for it, and she is just a fantastic Wonder Woman artist, in my opinion. And then the other issue of Batman that I read was the first part of a new Poison Ivy storyline that honestly, you know, was a lot of setup in that first issue, and a lot of things were happening that I couldn't really follow. So I can't really comment too much on that one. It was a little difficult to follow for a new story setup. I'm actually now up to date on The Mighty Thor, which continues to be far and away the best book that Marvel is publishing and arguably the best book in comics, barreling towards the apparent death of the Jane Foster Thor as we prepare for yet another Marvel relaunch. But just been thrilling, outstanding stuff. Can't wait to see how that all wraps up. Detective Comics, I'm caught up now. Completed the Fall of the Batman storyline that ended in a heartbreaker. And really has shaken the core of the Batman of the team, and makes it look like it's something they're not going to be able to come back from. I am very interested to see how James Tynion IV closes out his now, you know, pretty damn strong run on Detective Comics. By the time it's all said and done, he is going to have written, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of like 35 issues of Detective Comics, and it's one of the stronger runs on that book in recent memory, in my opinion. I also got caught up on Jessica Jones, which continues just be outstanding. Brian Michael Bendis on writing a Jessica Jones book is something that I never want to see go away, even though I know it's going to have to here recently. The Return of the Purple Man was something I was very skeptical about, and yet they have made it work. I mean, it has been a very worthy successor to the initial Purple Man stuff, and I cannot wait to see how he brings this to a close here in the next couple of months. I also caught up on Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps. Enjoyed it, but a little bit down, I think, from the typical high bar that book is set. The Controllers, I you know, didn't find them to be overly compelling villains, so that story arc was not that great, although it did have fantastic Four Horsemen references throughout it, and including a scene where they argue over which of them would be the group's Ric Flair. And I think, you know, if...
Are you serious?
Yes.
Oh, Jesus.
And I think there's...
How have I not read this?
I think there's no doubt the answer to that question, by the way. I mean, like,
yeah.
Hal Jordan is the only one to have rumored that has slept with a 16-year-old, so he's clearly the Ric Flair of the group, in my opinion.
Yes.
What else did I catch up on? I think there was something else. Oh, Spider-Man, Brian Michael Bendis's Miles Morales book, dealing with the return, spoiler alert, of his uncle Aaron to the Aaron Davis to the continuity, revealing that the events of Secret Wars have restored him to life and that he is once again up to no good and now coming into conflict with his nephew. And I am very much enjoying that one. Miles continues to get the...
Wasn't Secret Wars like 2-3 years ago, something like that?
Yeah, and Bendis has kind of been slowly revealing that, you know, there are still ramifications out there of characters who have been returned to life. The implication here being that he's kind of been lurking around in the background and only just now coming into direct conflict with Miles. But yeah, Miles also going through something of an existential crisis, questioning whether he even wants to be Spider-Man or whether he wants to go off and forge his own path in the Marvel Universe. So I think there's probably a pretty big status quo shakeup coming for Miles once Bendis leaves and somebody else takes over that character. And I'm trying to think. I think that's it. I think that is the Green Arrow. Actually, Green Arrow. Caught up on Green Arrow. Enjoyed that one, even though it is starting to fall off a bit from some of the highs. I know you're not as high on the Ben Percy run as I have been at times, but I still am enjoying this book and looking forward to see how Percy wraps up. He's another guy who's had a pretty lengthy run. I think he's going to have wound up doing almost, well, if you count before the Rebirth launch, he's done over 40 issues of the character at this point, and everything has kind of been building to this big confrontation with him and the Ninth Circle and this trial that's going on. So looking forward to that. And then finally, Aquaman I got caught up on, and Aquaman is just, it is outstanding. It's beautifully drawn, beautifully written, and the new subplot with he and Mira is certainly a heartbreaker. You know, it has me very concerned about the long-term future of that relationship, even though I can kind of understand it from story reasons. I'm just interested to see how they're going to deal with this new status quo, because what they are teasing is something that would be, you know, a definite shakeup for the dynamic between those two characters, and something that I hope Dan Abnett has the intention of staying on to chart the future of. So, lots of reading this week.
Are you going to be following her solo miniseries?
Never mind. I was going to say, does a bear shit in the woods? But that's neither here nor there.
If a bear shits in the woods, that's an entertaining sitcom.
Does the Iron Sheik shoot in the woods? How about that?
The Iron Sheik shoots on Mr. Wrestling Tim Woods whenever he feels like it.
The point being, yes, I'm going to read it, of course.
Yes. Okay. Quite good. Now let us move on to watching. And thanks to the CW's bizarre scheduling and intense fear of the Winter Olympics, we only have one.
Which, you know, we mocked that the last 2 weeks, Greg, but apparently curling did monster numbers in the ratings.
Yes, it's insane. I watched most of the Winter Olympics I watched was that little bit when we were sitting at the barbecue restaurant the other day waiting on our food.
The speed skating where they would
The
speed skating where half the race they went really slow.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't really pick up the pace until, you know, I think we watched like the endurance speed race. But, you know, why not just, I don't know. Winter Olympics wasn't for me, but. We only had one show to watch last week, Nick, and that was, or do we want to stretch it and include the premiere of The Walking Dead?
Well, we don't typically include, Walking Dead, I am certainly willing to discuss, but, we don't include it in our CW discussion. It's a separate entity unto itself.
True. So, we had...
Plus, I know certain individuals are waiting to hear my thoughts on Walking Dead, so we're going to make them wait. You're going to have to listen to the very end to get those.
DC's Legends of Tomorrow. This is the show that gave us, in that episode, of course, it was one episode removed from the fate of Damian Dark's daughter, Nora. And so in this episode, we actually got a Groundhog Day homage as it focuses on the character of, help me out, Nick.
Zari,
thank you. I kept wanting to say Zuri, but I was like, no, that's the Black Panther character. Why do I keep thinking that name? Anyway, Zari. It focuses on the character of Zari, and she gets stuck in a Groundhog Day style time loop, and has to find a way to break this time loop, it seems, or the whole team's going to die. And as a result, it ends up creating just a remarkably fun episode.
Yep.
Another in a line of just great episodes that just remind you of why we love Legends of Tomorrow. It's an episode only Legends could do, and it emphasizes everyone on the team. They all get a moment. We get to see everybody's kind of good side and bad side, and it. I gotta say, Nick, it does so much to make me care about Zari to a degree that, you know, not that she had some good episodes before this, but this gives her so much more than just the sarcastic, dry, you know, as Sarah puts it in the episode, just the person that just kind of acts cooler than everybody. this gives her a totally different dynamic to her character. I thought this was a legitimately great episode. Probably maybe one of the best on Legends of Tomorrow.
I would agree wholeheartedly. When I sat down to watch the episode, I knew it was going to be a Groundhog Day homage. I was looking forward to that aspect. But as I started to watch it, I kind of saw that it was going to be, from largely Zari's point of reference, I was a little concerned because she hasn't been the most compelling or well-fleshed-out character on the show to this point. But this episode, in addition to, like you said, being a lot of damn fun, goes a long way towards resolving a lot of those issues with Zari as a character. Mm-hmm. Actual growth and development, and now, rather than just being somebody who happens to be on the ship, she feels like a full-fledged member of the team and feels like somebody that genuinely cares about her teammates and her teammates genuinely care about her. So have character development with that, and then like also set it against the backdrop of this great Groundhog Day homage that provides us with just hilarious scene after scene after emotional scene. And like, yeah, it's up there for, best episode of the season. And probably would make a short list of the, best episodes in Legends of Tomorrow history in general. I absolutely loved it. So the CW may have not given us a lot of out this week, but the quality in that one episode was outstanding.
Totally agree. And I think I speak for everyone when I say I really want to read Mick Rory's erotic science fiction novel.
Yes, his erotic science fiction romance. I'll tell you what I want, and I know we talk sometimes, Greg, about how less is more, and I understand why it doesn't happen because of the the ratings for Legends of Tomorrow aren't as high as ratings for like The Flash or Arrow, but the writers have done such a phenomenal job the last 2 years. I want to see them get 23 episodes finally. Get the same episode order as Flash and Arrow and let them stand on equal footing, because creatively they've deserved it. And don't force them to rotate time slots with another show, which is stupid.
Totally freaking agreed, Nick. Totally agreed. And the thing about Legends that makes it different is Legends doesn't have to face the same struggles that The Flash and Arrow and Supergirl do of having to stretch out to 26 episodes sometimes, because Legends can just do one-off episodes whenever they want.
Yes. Yes, they can.
They can just throw in a one-off where they're in the 1950s or something.
I mean, and they have the Mollus thing, which is kind of being stretched out a little bit too much, in my opinion, at this point. But they have so many other compelling things going on that you don't care they're stretching out the Mollus thing. Whereas stuff like Flash and Arrow, they kind of have just that one central villain that they have to stretch out artificially. So
almost
Legends just continues to show that it's at the peak of its powers right now.
Absolutely. Almost to the point where I don't even really care how they deal with Mollus. I just want to see them in their next time period,
Right.
But anyway, yeah, really good stuff. So now we're going to get on to the main event of the evening. We're probably jumping ahead of our schedule or what we would usually do, Nick, or am I wrong on that? We usually do Walking Dead the following week.
No, I think we usually do Walking Dead week of. I think we do yeah, because Flash airs on Tuesdays, so we typically do. Yeah, we'll go Monday to Sunday is our week typically. So
yeah, so The Walking Dead came back from its mid-season break with their premiere this week.
Yes, it did.
As everyone remembers, the big reveal at the end of the mid-season finale is that Carl had been bitten by a walker in a position on his body where there was no hope of survival. Right on the side of his torso. This episode was, it's interesting because I thought the episode would entirely be about Carl. I thought it would be all about his
No, because death. That would be far too fucking boring, Greg. So we had to actually have some interesting things in the episode as well.
So, but instead, it kind of picks up our storyline where it left off. We get to see what's going on with Ezekiel. We get to see what's going on with Morgan and Carol and all of the other survivors that are sitting underneath Alexandria right now in these tunnels beneath the city. And we also do get a flashback to how Carl got bitten, which we had speculated on before, I think, and we're correct on our speculation about when it happened. Nick was, I should say. I don't want to take credit for that because I was very confused about the whole thing, but Nick was right that it happened when rescued Sadiq. And we also get into the Flash.
Which coincidentally, Greg, now Sadiq and that random walker who bit Carl have both jumped into my Fave 5.
They're in your Fave 5?
Fave 5.
Oh my gosh, the Fave 5. That's an elite list that we haven't even referenced in ages.
That's right.
Ever.
That's right.
So
that's a new reference for people who thought we needed more obscure ones on the show.
We need more obscure wrestling references. The Fave 5 for Nick now includes Walker, who bit Carl, and
Sadiq. As well as, of course, Eugene, Jerry, and player to be named later.
Daryl?
There's a lot of people in the running for that fifth spot, Greg. You know, it's tough for me to say, but if push comes to shove right now, I think I'd probably go... Yeah, I'll go with Ezekiel. There you go. Ezekiel, Jerry, Eugene, and Zeke, and Walker, who bit Carl.
And, of course, Cordell Walker.
What? We don't know that man's name is Walker?
No, I'm talking about Walker, Texas Ranger. His name was Cordell Walker.
I thought you were making another Hannibal reference. My mistake.
It could be both. It doubles.
Oh God! How awesome would it be if that was the case? if Chuck Norris played Cordell in the Hannibal remake.
Oh, that would be amazing. So we also, of course, got Carl's tearful goodbyes to all of his loved ones. Well, most of his loved ones. Some of them weren't there. He wrote letters to all of them, which will unfold it certainly in upcoming episodes. Letters to people like Enid and presumably Maggie and others. But here he gets to say goodbye to Daryl and Sadiq and Judith and Rick and Michonne. And in addition to that, we get to see some other badass stuff going on. But let's just focus on the main event of the evening right now. And that main event was Carl's slow, agonizing death that played out on screen. Now, while the rest of the country was mourning and weeping along with Carl and his loved ones, what was going on in the Duke compound?
Just a big goofy grin. It was glorious. And it was so, you know, the beautiful thing about it, Greg, is not just that Carl died. You know, that was great. That was outstanding. It's one of the best things that's ever happened on that show, bar none. But they really did a great job in that episode in trying to make people care about Carl, reminding you of just how terrible he truly is. Because he was doing things that you don't care about. Nobody cares about Carl sitting there writing letters. They especially don't care about him, you know, clichedly, like something out of a fucking indie movie, staring contentedly into the sunshine after writing his letters as he accepts his fate. Oh, my God.
I used to stare at the sun with a pair of binoculars.
No, he stared up and closes his eyes as the sun shines down upon him, and he gives a faint smile, like in something out of a fucking terrible indie movie. It looks like something we would have seen in Running with Scissors back when we watched it in college, unfortunately. It was so fucking stupid. And then, throughout the episode, they remind you over and over this nonsensical character direction they had for Carl, where he just all of a sudden off-screen went from being the most bloodthirsty little bastard on the show to Mr. Pacifist Carl Grimes, to the point where his closing words are essentially, "Hey, Dad, my perfect vision of this world is for you to go back to being boring farmer Rick and for Negan to become redeemed and just be a guy who digs holes and speaks kindly to Judith." A.K.A. the most boring version of The Walking Dead imaginable. So I'm glad Carl's gone. Fuck him. Bye.
Oh, God.
Carl's vision of the show is a version of the show I have no interest in watching whatsoever.
Yeah, well, not only that. Okay, here's the thing. I could get behind Carl's vision, but the sad thing, Nick, I knew where it was going. Because I know enough about the comics to know how they resolved the Negan thing in the comics. And my God, I never hoped more for a diversion.
Yeah.
Because it's stupid. It is stupid on a level that I cannot... could become show-breaking stupid if that's where they go. But My hope is that by showing that that's Carl's fantasy vision, that that means it won't happen. They made a big point of Rick promising Coral on his deathbed that he'll make it become a reality. I hope he doesn't, because here's the thing. Carl's vision involves Negan being reformed and digging holes, as you so eloquently put it. There's no scenario at this point. We've been over this countless times now, Nick. In the world of The Walking Dead, there is no scenario in which you leave Negan alive.
No. None.
I love Negan. Negan is an incredibly entertaining character. But I'm just saying, when the time comes, Negan dies or the show is fucking stupid.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it makes Rick the biggest idiot on the face of the planet. Like, I have zero interest in seeing Negan redeemed. Like, don't get me wrong, he is an awesome character, and I love to watch him, and he's charismatic as hell, and Jeffrey Dean Morgan gives a great performance. But him and Rick fighting side by side would make zero sense. In a show that is about, you know, the dead walking the earth and destroying civilization, that might be the most unbelievable thing they would have ever done.
Yes.
If that happens. It would be
beyond stupid. Had how many seasons now of object lessons in the dangers of leaving your enemies alive in the world of The Walking Dead? And we can talk about real life is different from the world of The Walking Dead. The world of The Walking Dead has made it clear that there is no redemption. Because if you leave your enemy alive, your enemy is going to murder your ass.
Yes. Who was the guy we learned it with most explicitly? I'm trying to remember.
Well, there were the cannibals.
There was the guy what's his fucking name? Tyrese let go. Came back to bite him in the ass. I can't remember who it was.
Yep. Every time. Every single time. The governor. Letting the governor live. You know, like, like that won't come back to haunt you. You know, and it every character in the freaking show that they've come across, that they've lived, with the exception of, like, Father Gabriel, I guess, has come back to freaking kill them, to haunt them.
Yes.
Daryl leaving Dwight alive, remember?
Yes.
Daryl helped out Dwight, and then Dwight comes back and freaking ruins everything. Like, you cannot let them alive. That's retarded. And I hate to use that word, but that's what it is. It's just stupid. It's absolutely stupid. Stupid.
But
anyway,
let us not lose sight of the real important thing here. Carl is fucking dead.
Yes, Carl's dead. Carl's dead.
Yes. 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 Good. That's good.
Now, other stuff did happen on the episode besides Carl dying.
Yeah.
I thought that Andrew Lincoln and Danai Guerra gave great performances in watching Carl die his agonizing and, to some, entertaining death. They were good. The acting, again, was really good across the board, I thought, except for young Judith. But can't really hold it against the kid. She's extremely young. I thought the worst scene of the episode was Carl's goodbye to Judith.
I did too. And then his stupid face scared her and made her cry because his face is so just fucking stupid and infuriated.
But did you see him on Talking Dead? He cut his hair.
I didn't watch Talking Dead. I hope to never see Chandler Riggs on my television again.
Oh. What if? Well, I can't even think of a scenario. I couldn't even think of a scenario that would get you to enjoy watching Chandler Riggs, so never mind. But other stuff happened in this episode, too. Ezekiel tried to reason with one of Negan's lieutenants, whose name escapes me, because he's mostly unimportant. But Zeke tried to get him to back down to surrender, but he was not willing to. And he paid the ultimate price in the form of being stabbed to death with a stick by a young child.
Oh, that was good stuff. That was good stuff, sure. You know, I enjoyed that whole little subplot, even if, again, I did not distract at all from, you know, I knew why I was there, put it that way. But, yes, good stuff, and good to see Morgan used in a much more logical fashion than he
had. Yeah, that's what I was going to get to. We got to see Morgan go Punisher on this entire Morgan and Carol, actually. Morgan and Carol working together to go Punisher on this whole group of saviors as they infiltrate Ezekiel, which they succeed in. But it's not just saving Ezekiel, and it's not just going Punisher on their asses, but there's one scene in particular involving Morgan that may be one of the most badass things I've ever seen on The Walking Dead, and that's when he is grappling with one of the saviors who's trying to kill him, obviously, and Morgan reaches into an open wound and pulls the man's intestines out.
Yes.
Awesome.
Yes, he did.
They even did this cool bit where that savior lieutenant runs away and hides in this little like tube or whatever, and it's almost like right out of a horror movie, like something you see on Friday the 13th, as Morgan is just slowly stalking him, and he sees Morgan's shadow, and then Morgan's shadow disappears, and he kind of lets out a breath, and then Morgan like yanks him from wherever he's hiding and pulls him out, like incredibly badass, incredibly. Fun to watch. I thought this was a really good episode, Nick, overall.
Yeah, I do too. Hard to say much else about it other than thank God Carl is dead and good to see Morgan redeeming himself.
Absolutely. And with all that being said, that wraps up reading and watching as far as I know, Nick, unless you've watched anything else.
Not that I can think of, no.
Well, with that coming to a close, let's tell the people what we've got coming up ahead for them.
Oh, one other thing. Off topic, Greg. I just wanted to preemptively extend my congratulations to you and other friends of ours. I know it's been you as Alabama fans have enjoyed an unprecedented run of success over the last, 10 years. National championships, SEC championships, and soon life championships. And I just wanted to say congratulations.
Well, you know, I think that that's the thank you. I think that's the one thing that's missing was the Carl Childers like personality of Butch Jones to really add some.
I mean, but like champions of life. Think about like God, that's huge, and that is important.
Because a national championship only lasts what a year.
A year.
You know, you don't go back and say, "Hey, won the national
maybe
championship
a few more days.
Whatever year."
Yeah, yeah.
But the life championship is
right.
Forever.
It's forever. You're always like,
or at least for the duration of the time that Butch Jones is on your staff.
Right, right. I mean, you know. So that's exciting. That's exciting for sure.
And he was given quote an off-field role.
Mm-hmm.
So I can only imagine that means that he's the life coach for the team.
Yeah, I mean that's his best role, undoubtedly. You know, and he will do a great job of building things brick by brick.
Absolutely, and he will continue to have no neck whatsoever.
And speak in coach cliches, which we all know are a favorite pastime of our good friend Andrew Chandler Frazier Garner the 17th.
Yes, he hears many of them in his time, and has grown quite fond of them. So what do we have coming the folks' way in the coming weeks? I can go ahead and tell you our long book hunt is a change, but we don't know to what yet.
It's going to change. Ah, okay. Yeah, I didn't know that either. Yeah, why is it changing?
It's changing because I don't have the trade of Court of Owls.
Oh.
I ain't digging out my individual issues.
Oh, why not?
Because I'm about to have to move, and I don't feel like taking things out of my closet.
Oh.
Instead of...
When are you moving?
Well, I got we're getting inside baseball here, Nick, but I have become aware in the last... Oh, when I got from your house, that my rent is about to go up significantly again.
Uh huh.
So I'm joining the rent is too damn high party and seeking to find a way to not live here anymore. So, oh, by the way, I was lying. I actually do have the Court of Owls book, but I don't have the second one. I don't have the follow up. So,
okay.
It just have to be the initial trade.
All right, we'll make some determinations out about that. Probably then we will be doing Court of Owls as a long book hunt in next week, actually, is the plan. Before then going off the page for a look back at one of your favorite films, Greg, Spider-Man 2. And then, actually, let me do a little research here. I may make an executive decision. real quick. Yeah.
While he's doing that, I'm going to contact our executive consultant, Mr. Perfect.
Mm-hmm. So what we're actually going to do, in the interest of making it easier for you to read the long book, Greg, we're going to move the long book hunt to the end of the month. We're going to move that to the third week in March. We're going to do Spider-Man 2 next week, and that lines up because our landmark 100th episode will now be a very special edition of Countdown where, you know, you know, it's our 100th episode, so we need a big... We're going to count down our five favorite DC comic stories of all time. Any five stories, any five characters, everything is wide open. So it should be interesting to see how different lists are in terms of relationships to different characters and stuff like that. Looking forward to it. We are approaching the landmark episode 100.
That's actually not where I thought you were going either. I thought you were going to actually... I thought we were going to follow through on my threat for us to do a countdown of the five episodes of the Hard Traffic Fanboys.
You know, we should do that.
The circle of our egocentrism.
You know, we should do that at some point. Honestly, we could do that for our 2-year anniversary show, which is just four episodes after our 100th show.
self-serving and egocentric.
Yes.
So all of that just sounds wonderful, and I'm sure you're all going to look forward to it. And Place to Be Nation Pop Theater, folks, is in the pipeline.
Tentatively scheduled for a release date of March 29th. We can tentatively say that. That may move forward or backward, more likely backward, but...
Sir?
Yes?
John tentatively,
but I can say... There is audio in the can, so to speak. So there you are.
And this, as unique as our initial Watchmen adaptation was, this one may be even more so.
Even more so. It's possible.
And all I have to say to that is, meh.
Oh, Greg, is there you have to go for a certain member of your family? Tonight.
Huh? I have to go to the store to get some things for Mother.
in lieu of a lightning round this week,
and
I'm
that
going
store,
to give you
the Food Lion, of course.
The Food Lion. Out back, there were some interesting noises coming from my mother and the individual. I shan't name it this time. But in lieu of a lightning round, I am going to introduce what will become an occasionally occurring segment on our show.
Much like the lightning round, just whenever we feel like it.
Whenever we feel like it. And it's called The Wrestling Minute.
Oh, God.
I'm going to.
We are dancing on a slippery slope, Greg. A very slippery slope.
I've got my stopwatch out. Oh, I'm going to hit the timer. I'm going to give us 1 minute on the board to talk about wrestling.
Oh, God.
And we start right now. Nick, what did you make our watch of New Japan over the weekend?
Oh, my God, it was awesome. Tetsuya Naito is one of the greatest talents in this business right now. Unique, and I think he's a good guy, unlike that bastard Kazuchika Okada.
Actually, I disagree with you. I think Okada's the way to go. Naito is a cheater. He has struck the official many times, and I, for one, do not appreciate how much leeway Red Shoes gives individuals in contacting him during the match.
That's something, you know, a goody two-shoes Bret Hart fan like yourself say. Red Shoes has repeatedly inserted himself into precarious positions that Naito, out of the goodness of his heart, has sought to remove him from, to save him. And you blame Tetsuya Naito. And you talk about all his underhanded tactics and stuff like that. He is just the voice of a new generation, Greg. He doesn't want to be the Leave It to Beaver like personality of Bret Hart or Kazuchika Okada.
He is blazing
a new trail, much like Stone Cold Steve Austin did before him.
That's a minute. And that has been the Wrestling Minute, folks. Join us next time as we discuss comic books and more right here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Nick, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hard traveling fanboys.